This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, delivering specialty foods and ingredients right to your restaurant, bakery, and bar. Learn more at parisgourmet.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's MEAT+THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey gang, just a final reminder, this is your last chance to apply for the San Pellegrino Young Chef Competition. The deadline is April 30th. This is the final show that will air before the deadline. This is my last chance to help encourage you to apply for what I think will be a great experience. Details are available at sampellegrino.com or via the link in the bio on this show's Instagram account. The handle is at Chef Podcast. Please apply, and I hope to see you at the regional semifinals in New York City in November.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am here with my beloved, my spouse. What's the face?
No, that just sounded really funny.
My beloved.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Caitlin Friedman.
Yes, that is my name.
How are you?
I'm great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why are you great? You had a vacation.
I think that might be why I'm great.
Yeah, you and our daughter went away this weekend.
Mohonk Mountain House.
The Mohonk Mountain House in, do we say upstate New York?
Yeah, it's in New
Westchester, New York?
It's in New Paltz.
That's upstate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had such a good time.
Yeah.
I did yoga. I meditated.
Uh-huh.
I went on like four hikes,
yes.
Five hikes.
You engaged in self-care.
Yeah. I feel completely realigned.
Realigned?
Yeah. That's the word.
That is a term I usually reserve for an automobile.
Okay, well, okay, I feel
not the sexiest
realigned.
Comparison, but
okay,
there it is.
There you go.
There it is.
I feel good. That's why I'm good.
Caitlin, I have a great. This is a great show.
Is it?
This is one of these things we're doing with more and more regularity.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of these extravaganzas where I went to a conference. Actually, this was called the Anti Convention, an organization called Chef's Roll,
mm-hmm.
invited me to be a part of what they called the Anti-Convention, which I kind of love because there's an abundance right now, an embarrassment of riches of chef conferences, symposiums, gatherings.
Discussions. Brain trusts.
They called this the Anti-Convention, which I thought was very clever.
Yeah.
It was in San Diego. They invited me to participate. I moderated a panel on chefs, drugs, and rock and roll, which was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I participated in a panel about chefs and media, which I actually, this is my new barometer for whether or not these conferences are worth it. Do these talks, symposiums, et cetera, convey useful intel? You don't come to these events, but you go to a lot of industry stuff for your industry,
yeah,
the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
I think, you know, right now...
Yeah,
there's,
when you learn something.
You actually learn something that you can take to the bank, that you can act on.
Yeah, I do like that.
That where you're not just engaging in what I've now called commiseration rituals, like where there's actually useful information being conveyed. And I will say that the amazing thing about the Chef's Roll Convention, which was... I didn't know until I got there the first day of the event, that because it was in Southern California, in San Diego, and you can do this kind of thing there... The entirety of the convention was outdoors.
I would get the worst sunburn.
It actually was really hot the first day, but
yeah,
I loved it.
I would die.
Freaking loved it.
Yeah.
It was an amazing setup they had. The audience setup was outdoors. The stage was like fit for a talk show. It was like an elevated stage with like loungy chairs and stuff like that. Lunch, you know, they had things like barbecue and tacos made to order from the barbecue and stuff like that. It was really, really very, very much of its place.
It also sounds really well organized.
It was really well organized.
Yeah, that always makes a difference.
And it was a great group of people. So it was hard for me to pick, but I selected 5 chefs to interview. And that's what this special is. And, you know, I did the Philadelphia Chefs Conference a few weeks ago. It was a 3-hour-plus show. Your eyes just widened when I said
that. I'm just wondering, how many hours is this one?
This is going to be... I haven't finished editing as you and I sit here right now. It's going to be a little under 3 hours, I think.
Okay.
But here's the thing. We are technically beyond the end of the winter season. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a few weeks before there's a new show. So all of you listeners who were looking at this show, it popped up in your queue and you thought, is he crazy? He's doing such a long episode. The actual interviews are shorter than my typical episodes. And this should last you through the break between seasons until our new shows start to show up later in May. I think that's actually terrific.
Yeah, that's actually pretty good.
Yeah. So here are the chefs that I picked from the abundance of riches at this conference. I tried to pick a group that was diverse, and that's kind of my thing, right? And in as many ways as possible, generational, geographic, point of view, et cetera, et cetera. So on this episode, I have a conversation with the legendary, I think at this point, Chef Barbara Lynch of Boston, Massachusetts. Kind of, you know, there was Lydia Shire for years. Lydia's still active. And I would say that the queen in waiting of the Boston culinary scene is Barbara Lynch. She's got like almost 10 restaurants there. Wrote a wonderful book called Out of Line. We talk about all this. Barbara and I have a really fun chemistry because I'm kind of a geek and she's kind of a tough girl from South Boston. And we both know our places. And I know she thinks she could just roll me and take me for all my money if she just wanted to.
She might be able to do that.
She could.
Yeah.
No, and she admits to it.
So I'm saying, like, she says it to my face. Right.
She says it to my face. I love Barbara Lynch. So that was one. Claudette Zepeda Wilkins of El Jardin Restaurant in San Diego. She was a terrific interview. We had never met before. Ken Frank, who's one of the gentlemen on the cover of my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. He was the original chef of Michael Santa Monica. A lot of people think the original chef was Jonathan Waxman, who took over a few months in. But Ken Frank was actually the original chef. Are you actually taking a sip of your margarita as I'm doing this show?
It's not a margarita.
Okay, what is it?
It's just straight up tequila.
Well, no, it's tinted. You put some lime juice in there?
There's a little lime juice.
Little lime juice, okay.
I'll put it down. I don't want to distract
you. Well, I always say there's no spring in New York.
Right.
You go from winter to summer. All of a sudden, it's basically summer here. So in the Friedman household, we are now tequila crazy.
It's true.
I have a mezcal margarita next to me here.
But you're not drinking
it? No, not while I'm on the air.
Okay.
Anyway, Ken, for years, has had the restaurant La Toque in the town of Napa in Northern California. I really like Ken Frank a lot. We had a spectacular interview. Francisco Magoya is the chef of Mexican descent, who is part of the Modernist Cuisine Organization, co-author of Modernist Bread. He had done a presentation at Chef's Roll, and he's one of these people, Caitlin, honestly, I just feel like I'm lucky to keep up. He's so freaking smart. He's you know, he's a chef, but he's also, you know, he's basically a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
He's super smart.
Mm-hmm.
We had never met before. I feel like we had a little bit of a bromance.
Really?
Yeah.
Should I be jelly or happy?
No. He was just a great guy. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, we, you know, both kept talking about how much we enjoyed the interview.
Wait, did you exchange numbers?
No. He has his people. I never asked for people's phone numbers.
I just didn't know how far the bromance.
No. But the funny thing is, we ran into each other at dinner at about 10 o'clock at night in San Diego later that night. And you're drinking more tequila.
I'm just having a sip. Uh huh.
Anyway, Francisco. We had a great conversation. It was really great. And then he and I were stationed next to each other signing books right afterwards, and we kept talking about how great the interview was.
Aww.
You know, when you just click with somebody.
I love that feeling.
I felt like I made a new pal.
I love that.
Yeah. I invited him to actually come on the show when he's in New York sometime and do a proper biographical interview, because we really confined ourselves to talking about the modernist thing. But the guy's got a great story. Anyway, I think you guys will enjoy that. And Naisha Arrington of Los Angeles, California, who I had never met.
Great name.
Great name. That's an interesting comment.
That's a really good name.
So we had never met. The night prior to our interview, my buddy and your buddy, Carol Chin, introduced us at a dinner. And this is another one. I think I made a new friend.
Aww.
I think Naisha and I are going to be pals.
That's awesome.
Yeah. She's got this incredible, incredible energy. She just recently closed her second restaurant that she had to close in Los Angeles. She had the restaurant Wilshire, which she closed a while back.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the last month or so, she closed Native. Mm. But when you meet her, she's just like, you know when you meet someone and you're like, this person must do like a lot of yoga and drink a lot of water. And they just seem to have this real healthful everything
That's
about
gonna
them.
That's going to be me, honey.
When?
Soon.
We're going to be at the LA Chef Conference together next month. But she is just, God, I loved her energy. We had a great conversation. That's another, what do you call it? It's not a bromance. She's a woman.
I think it's just a straight-up romance.
No, it's not a romance. That would be inappropriate.
I said it.
You said it. You're my wife.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we've had some nice exchanges. She told me on Instagram.
Did you guys exchange
numbers? No. But on Instagram the other day, she said, I could have talked to you all day.
Aww,
and then
please.
You'll know how much I appreciate this. You know what emoji she put next to that? A brain.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, Caitlin, this is a great little quintet of interviews that I'm sharing here. And here's the amazing thing. This is only the half of it, because I'm saving for after we come back from hiatus.
Mm-hmm.
The guest of honor at this conference was Jeremiah Tower. And Jeremiah, you know, there was a documentary about Jeremiah called The Last Magnificent. Jeremiah, like many people of his generation, all they get interviewed about is the past.
Yeah, that's true.
But Jeremiah has this unbelievably vital contemporary life that he's living. He's all over the place. He's doing a lot of stuff.
He does travel a lot.
No, he's at a lot of events. Yeah. He went directly from this event to another one.
Yeah.
So we did an interview that was exclusively about present-day Jeremiah Tower.
That's a cool idea.
Right?
Yeah.
And
was he into it?
Yes, always. Jeremiah's up for anything. I love that guy. So anyway, we did that. And then a bunch of people who had been cooks of his at Stars, his legendary restaurant, who were now chefs in their own right, have their own restaurants, did a tribute dinner to him on the first night of the Chef's Roll anti-convention. And I interviewed a bunch of those people about Jeremiah.
Oh, that's cool.
And I'm in the process of editing all this together into a little Jeremiah tribute that I think will be, even for people who saw the movie The Last Magnificent, even for people who read California Dish or read the reissued version of California Dish under its name Start the Fire,
mm-hmm.
I actually think there will be new things there.
That's
going to air
next season.
Well, the next season meeting in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be a little special thing we drop, but
that's
it's
cool.
I think that's going to be great. Anyway, should I get right to it?
Yeah.
No. I'm not going to get right to it.
What?
Because as I mentioned in the little teaser to the show, Caitlin, you know, I've been very excited about my relationship, my new relationship with Sam Pellegrino.
Friendship.
Yeah. It's a promotional partnership.
Yeah.
I've been drinking Sam Pellegrino my whole life. I don't just say that. You know it.
And now Taylor's drinking it.
And now our daughter's drinking their sodas, actually. I'm talking about Sam Pellegrino. The water,
yeah.
Which, as you know, forever, when I go to a restaurant,
that's what you're ordering.
And I'm feeling fancy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I order. I don't drink that New York water or however people refer to that. I drink Pellegrino, San Pellegrino.
It's true, you do.
And I recently entered into, and I'm just tickled about this, a promotional partnership with them. Their Young Chef competition is happening. It's sort of a two-year time frame, right? So this year, 2019, the regional winners are selected. Mm-hmm. And then those people square off in Italy and the global finals in 2020, okay? Now, the North American semifinals are taking place in New York this November, and all 10 semifinalists are going to be interviewed on a special episode of this show, kind of like this episode that I'm running today, right? Except instead of it being Chef's Roll or the Philly Chef's Conference or the Cayman Cookout, I'm going to be at the San Pellegrino Young Chef Competition North American semifinals, and I'm going to be interviewing the 10 semifinalists. That's really cool. That happens, though, to be the least of it. The main thing is that if you're there, you're a semifinalist for the North American region of the San Pellegrino Young Chef Competition. That's a big deal. And whoever wins that will then go on to compete in 2020 in the global finals in Italy.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And whoever wins the North American semifinals will have their own episode of this show. One-on-one interview with yours truly, just like, you know, the way we run an episode with Massimo Bottura or Curtis Stone or whomever. They will have their own dedicated episode. Again, that's the least of it. The main thing is you've won the North American semifinals.
That's kind of amazing.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm just tickled about this whole thing. I've done this a few times. This will be the last time I do it, but this is the last show that runs before the deadline of April 30th, which is the date by which you need to apply. I am just going to one more time remind people that the competition is open not only to people with a chef title, but to most people who have been working in a professional kitchen for at least a year and who were born after February 1, 1989, meaning you're 30 years old or younger. If you're a more mature chef than that, I'd humbly suggest that maybe you recommend this contest to people who work for you or young chefs who used to work for you, you know, people to whom you are a mentor. I think this would be a great opportunity for them. The cornerstone of the competition is you developing a signature dish that shows your personal vision, unique skills, and creativity. For rules, details, and application, visit sampellegrino.com and navigate over to the competitions page. Again, it's a San Pellegrino Young Chef Competition. Or if you go to Andrew Talks to Chef's Instagram page, which the handle is very easy to remember, it's at Chef Podcast, in the link in the bio, you will be taken to a set of links, and the topmost link there is a direct one to the application. And again, Andrew Talks to Chefs has recently entered into a promotional partnership with San Pellegrino, and I look forward to sharing and being a part of more programs with my favorite water in the months to come. Isn't that great?
I love that.
Everybody wins. Mm-hmm. I win. Mm-hmm. San Pellegrino, I think, wins a little. People mm-hmm. who make the semifinals get a little extra oomph, a little extra thing.
Yeah, I think it's all great.
It's all great. Yeah. I'm really excited about it. I can't wait. Okay. With that, I am now going to turn it over to the first interview of this extravaganza from Chef's Roll. My conversation with Naisha Arrington, my new buddy, conducted on the very early morning of day two of the Chef's Roll anti-convention in San Diego a few weeks ago. Here you go. Oh, you got that smile down. Someone just took your picture. That has been practiced.
Yes. It comes from the heart.
I have a practiced one, too, but it looks awful.
It's
absolutely terrible. We just met last night at dinner.
Yes.
If you don't mind me making this the first thing I bring up,
You
closed a restaurant recently.
Yes.
Very recently.
Yes.
You know, I saw you last night. You look great, if you don't mind my saying.
Thank
you. You're just dressed to the nines.
Thank you.
You've got an amazing energy. You've
Thank
got
you.
This smile that doesn't stop. You seem to be in a very good place.
Probably more so than anyone I've ever met this close to the shuttering of a restaurant, which is painful.
Yeah, it's
personally painful. Can you talk to me about just how you're doing?
I love that you asked. So I've been cooking 16 years professionally now, mostly in Michelin kitchens.
Yep.
This is my second restaurant.
Yep.
And we were just under 2 years of operation. The space was very difficult. It was very challenging. We had a lot of plumbing and piping issues that we thought we sorted out early on, and they sort of resurfaced, and rising costs of everything,
yep.
commodities, healthcare, minimum wage, a lot of overhead, and it became very apparent to me that it wasn't going to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm fairly still young in my career, I want the 10-year plan, you know? I value life, and I value time and business.
Yeah.
And I consciously always aim for upward mobility in my career.
Yeah.
This was Restaurant 2. Very proud of it. It has a lot of deeper meaning to life than just four walls that serves food.
Yep.
The restaurant's called Native, mm-hmm. and it really celebrates people and culture and storytelling on the dinner plate. So I will not ever continue being passionate about that seed. And it takes a very disciplined mindset to say, you know, it didn't work there, but that doesn't mean that it won't work for me somewhere else.
Sure.
And that I get to dictate my life, you know, and I want to spend my time wisely, and I knew that it wasn't going to work there. And I have to say, while closing the restaurant was difficult, sure, you know, I'm a big believer in failing upward.
Okay.
But what hurt the most about that is the team. You know, I built an amazing team there, and the kids that I cooked next to on the last day of service, I will have in my life forever, and constantly check on them and make sure they're in good kitchens and,
uh-huh.
and pushing themselves. And I will always continue to have constant gentle pressure in them, as my mentors have done for me. But I have to say, the reason probably why I'm able to put that into one bucket or facet of a life experience is I did wholesome things for myself. You know, I went to Belize and I hung out with the people of Belize and immersed myself in the culture for 10 days there and learned a lot. And
first time there?
For first time there. And we shot this awesome documentary there.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And I went to 4 different islands, and I just got back 3 days ago. So
okay.
I think that probably has a little bit to do with
it. So you're not sitting on the couch
yeah,
feeling sorry for yourself and watching daytime television?
Quite the opposite. I feel very liberated. I'm getting to be here with you and talk about the good things in life and sit and watch Jeremiah Tyro be celebrated.
Yep.
And, you know, I like I said, it ends with me, and I'll never stop being passionate about cooking.
Great. There's a million things I'd ask you about that if I knew you better, but I don't want to dwell on the past, right?
Yeah.
But your background in terms of your family's sort of tendencies toward art and music, your own personal trajectory, I didn't know there was such a thing as the culinary program at the Art Institute of California.
Yes.
So there's been and I'm just going to say this because you wouldn't know this. We talked before the show, and this is often the case. You're not a regular listener to the show, so there's no way you would know this. But there's been an ongoing periodic discussion that happens here on whether or not cooking is an art or a craft, right? Like, we had Tom Colicchio on recently. Mm. You did some Top
Love
Chef
Tom
time.
So much.
But, you know, he has a restaurant called Craft,
yes.
right? There are people who have said, you know, cooking has, there are elements of self-expression which kind of make you think about art, but that most chefs I've interviewed seem to lean toward the craft side.
Yeah.
If you had to pick one or the other.
Yeah.
I mean, at some level, it's just semantics. Who cares, right?
Sure,
it is what it
course.
Is. But you very specifically, you've actually done dinners called Food is Art.
I have.
Yeah. Can you just speak, if I throw it out there this broadly, how you think about food in that context?
Yeah. Well, I love that you asked me this question. It's
Thank
something
you.
That is very organically that has resonated in my life. I grew up painting and sculpting, and I still do today. I actually started a painting last week that I'm really excited about. I feel like to say something is art, you are looking at a subject, and it's an intangible thought that you then create. And by creating that and making those connections, you're using a medium, right? So for me, it's food today. Tomorrow it could be acrylics.
Mm-hmm.
So on the perspective of art and looking at it through that lens, I believe that it's art because you're using food as the tool, as the facet to create. So then instead of, yeah, maybe color, but you get to play with temperature, you get to play with texture, you get to play with, you know, mouthfeel and all scents and aromas. So those are different mediums to use to create an experience that's not just visual. It lives in the soul. It lives in the mind. It can transcend someone to a place.
Uh-huh.
And those are very powerful things. And I like to call them food data. I think that when someone enjoys a dish, that lives in the soul forever.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sitting here with you today, and I can say, oh, you know, I had this amazing croissant with Andrew, and I was at the chef's roll, and, you know, and then you start to think about the layers and the flavors and the textures.
Sure.
That someone put as their craft, you know, to apply and make it an art. I believe that there are linear facets and parallels through craft and art. I think being an artist is a craft. A craftsman takes pride and passion in what they do.
That's the thing it takes to realize what's in your head.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. So, for me, I just happen to also be a visual artist in terms of using watercolors, acrylics, different mediums to create art that might sit on a wall, and then art that might sit on a plate.
So, people have said to me, I'm not arguing with you, I just want your response to this, but some chefs have said to me, like, everything you said, yes, but then there's two things, right? One is, it has to taste good, right?
Of course.
And then for most people, that's the most important thing. And the other thing is that you are limited in your medium to things that are edible, right? So my question is for you, like, hearing you talk just now, like, I would almost, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it would almost seem to me that you might say that that's just one other part of the medium.
What
is
exactly?
The flavor. Like how, I mean, you think about art sometimes, how it's going to reach somebody's eyes, right? Does that deepen it in your mind?
Well, yeah.
Does the question make sense?
No, it makes sense.
As opposed to limiting it?
As I understand, and what I had mentioned is there are different facets in, okay, so if you use a plate as a canvas, a chef uses texture, temperature, you know, those types of things as their medium, which is synonymous with flavor, which is, I think any chef really wants their guests to have an experience, you know? So in that respect, I see it as an art. I don't think that they're two different things to say that, you know, flavor cannot be an art.
Yeah.
I think there's an art in creating flavor, because when you put a spoonful of something in your mouth, your brain is receiving that as temperature, flavor, texture,
yep.
You know, salt, fat, acid, all those things, which it takes, it's a lot of things. It's chemistry, it's a lot of, you know, understanding the genetic makeup of a product.
Yeah.
And all of that, sure, is craft. I think it's a synonymous term.
Yeah.
And art, to master your craft. And I also feel, though, that chefs operate on such a high level of understanding that it's different. I mean, an artist, a visual artist, is not going to go and approach a dish cooking the same way a chef will.
Sure.
But a chef can approach art as an artist would.
Yeah.
Because they understand craft and what it is to be a craftsman.
Yeah. You talked a minute ago, thank you for all that. You spent some time, you just alluded to it, in some pretty fancy kitchens. You spent a bunch of time with Josiah Citron in Los Angeles. Was it Robuchon?
I went, yeah, Robuchon L'Atelier,
yeah.
The mansion.
Yeah. What drew you to those kitchens, and what was it like being there? And you know, someone of your generation spending time there.
Yeah, well, on the opposite subject of being an artist, I identify a lot of my DNA and who I am as being a chef. When I started cooking in 2002, I said to myself, first when I was in culinary school, I said, like, this is exactly what I want to do for the rest of my life, and I want to do it to the best of my ability. And then it kind of became daunting. I was like, wow, there's so many things. Like, here's this one thing. Here's mushrooms. Oh my God, there's like an entire world of mushrooms. Here's, you know, animal protein. There's an entire world of butchery, you know, and understanding that I wanted to know every single thing. I really want to master my craft, and that's what gets me out of bed early in the morning. It's what keeps me up late at night. So as I thought, wow, like, what can I do to love going to work every day?
Yeah.
I didn't know the answer to that.
Yes.
So I said, what can I do? I think I'd like to do it at the best level, and, you know, and then, and taco spots on the beach, you know, I think, and everywhere in between.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And that's what I did for the first 14 years of my career until I opened my first restaurant. Because I like cooking. I wasn't in a rush, you know, and not to say that my generation is different from the next generation, but I'm not an instant gratification girl. I like to put in the work. I like to see the fruits of the labor. Yeah. I like to strengthen the roots. And so for me, in my, I don't know if OCD is the right term to say, but in my brain, I operate very well in those kitchens. Like, this needs to go here every single day. That needs to go there. This needs to be right here. You know, these three steps need to happen before you even think about executing this. My, that's just how I'm wired.
Yep.
So that, I operate very well in those kitchens. And I don't have a big ego. Like, I came up in martial arts, and I have a very disciplined mindset. So I'm, and I played a lot of team sports growing up. So I feel like those tools and facets of my adolescence honed me to be good in those kitchens.
Totally.
You know?
You just mentioned two. This is all. It's always interesting to me when a chef had done both, because I find very often you find a chef who, as a, when they were young, you know, grade school, either did team sports or individual.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you did both.
Yes.
You did the martial arts.
Yes.
And I find very often it's reflected in what, not skills, but what sort of mindset they develop.
Yeah.
In the kitchen, right?
Yeah.
So the individual sports are really good for sort of, you know, self-expression, confidence.
Yes.
And all that, right?
Yes.
And the team sports are good for sort of like camaraderie and teamwork and
huge.
All that stuff. Can you speak to how these, first of all, what drew you to such different sports? What was the team sport you played?
Well, my dad, I played softball. My dad was the coach of my softball team from 5 until 16.
Okay.
And then I played soccer in high school. I was a center forward in junior high, and junior as a junior in high school and senior. And then I stopped martial arts because high school. I don't know, you know. And then I went to culinary school shortly after high school. But and then I joined like co-ed softball teams here and there. And then I'd rally and have, like, restaurant soccer teams.
I was going to say, did you do any industry stuff?
Totally.
Yeah, that's fun, right?
Oh, my God, it's the funnest.
Yeah, yeah. Especially in California, because you can be outside. There are people who do that in New York, and they're at some indoor, like, basketball facility, and it just seems depressing.
My dishwasher's out there with my servers, and, you know, that's the best.
That's great. But how did it serve you when you got to a kitchen? How did it translate, what you got from those things?
Well, a lot of it is leadership, you know. I am an innate leader, and it really came out, like, as I'm speaking about this, I'm thinking about, like, times when I was cooking on the line before we had got the 2 stars at Malise, and I was thrown in as a saucier beyond running the line, you know, and I was 20, I was still in my young 20s. And I haven't thought about this in a long time, and maybe one day I'll write a memoir, and I probably should, but I remember being in the trenches, it feeling like, at times on the line, and learning very quickly. You know, you have, you're thrown into the fire, so to speak, and you have to adapt, right? Or sink, or you freaking swim, or you fail, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember very quickly that if I didn't garner a team around me, even as a junior sous chef,
yeah,
that I was not going to do my job well.
Right.
You know? So I had to inspire people, you know, the entremet, the garmanger kids, the stagiaires around me to support me, to strain my stock, to skin my stock for me, or help me butcher, you know, set up my butcher station so that I can execute. And then I turned that into a love, you know, and I'd start to spend more time cooking family meal for the team. And that's where, you know, Josiah was like, you know, and it's something that always stuck with me. He's like, I always know the good chefs by the family meals that they make.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I loved that. And so I think the team sports really helped me understand how to be a leader and how to inspire and work together.
Yeah.
You know, you pass the ball to someone, that person can score. And
yeah.
And that's that sort of mindset.
Yeah. And also nonverbal communication, right?
Oh, my God. Huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's always, I think that's always a kind of an interesting thing. I think it's the same thing why so many musicians do well when they gravitate, because they've been on, you know, they can, like, with a little look on stage, know they're going to extend the song for another 30 seconds, you know, if the jam is going well.
Absolutely.
Right? So talk to me a little about, I'm not asking, like, like, what your thoughts are, if you have them yet, if you've been started thinking about them yet, for what you're going to do next. But can you just talk to me about L.A.? L.A. right now, right? Because my impression is that it's changing, that it's got, and all, and really the, well, there are big, obvious to me negative ways it's changing, which is, I'm sure it's a compliment to the city, but all these people that are going there now with concepts that started elsewhere, I feel like that didn't used to happen really in L.A., almost not at all.
No.
A lot of things started there and got exported. But now things are coming there, right? And I don't love going there and seeing things I can see in New York, right?
Yeah.
But that aside, I just feel like my impression was it's such a huge city. Huge cities, really, plural would be the accurate way to say it, right? That most people think of as the greater Los Angeles area.
Huge.
It's huge. There's a fair amount of money. You know, it's not as expensive as some, traditionally, as some other big cities. New York and San Francisco have always been perceived as more expensive. But, you know, more places are closing there now. It feels like it is just getting harder. Now, I should say, much of the time in this interview, your eyes have lit up. You've been smiling. You've been brightening at the mention of sports. I've just brought up this topic, and I just ended that question. Your entire energy, just like, I feel like I brought you down.
No, I'm just...
But it really...
I feel it.
You feel it.
What you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, it resonates because...
Can you speak to it for a minute?
I'm born and raised in L.A., you know, and my parents as well, and my grandparents met in the Korean War. My grandfather was a chef in the Korean War and brought my grandmother back to L.A., and they had my mom, and dad both grew up in Crenshaw area and had me, and we moved to the Antelope Valley when I was about 10, and then I moved to Santa Monica when I was 17, and I stayed with my grandma a lot during that time, but my dad didn't want us to grow up in Los Angeles because it was a little bit gang-ridden, started coming around, you know, late 80s, and but I remember understanding that L.A. had this spirit, and I can't say had, you know, but kind of.
Interesting.
The spirit to it that is so... it has so many facets to it. It's a little bit of grit, but this, like, elegance grit that is so beautiful. And unlike any other place, because of the terroir that Los Angeles is as a melting pot.
Uh-huh.
And... it's interesting to see more exponentially in the last 5 years than the previous 10. Have I seen this influx of people coming from different areas?
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about it yet. You know, I kind of had to tap out and really get a better perspective because it was a hard year for me this last 2 years. I think this was the most challenging years of my professional career. operationally and seeing what is it that I want to do, because there's no doubt. I mean, I feel like I'm successful at what I do as an individual, but I think it's hard as for operators. You have to find the right places, and a lot of those places right now, if you're not part of a bigger restaurant group, are like downtown, you know, Silver Lake area, where rent's not $25,000 a month like mine was.
Yeah.
You know, but which is cool. I think it's really an artsy area, downtown area, and all these places. But it's interesting, you know. I would love to not have the essence and the spirit of Los Angeles be diluted, because it's not as easy as coming in and just being a part of this scene, you know, like you said, like New York and or like, you know, getting what you can get in Los Angeles and New York. But it was a hard year, you know. We lost a lot of great people, and for me, people that directly impacted my life, you know. Anthony Bourdain, I remember reading his book cover to cover, Kitchen Confidential, and then back again when I was cooking on the line in 2005 2006, and meeting him at Barnes & Noble and rushing out on my one tiny little 20 minute break to go shake his hand. And Robichon, who passed away not too long after that, you know, who would walk in the kitchen, and now I'm tearing up. Tap my cheeks and say, like, Le Petit, and, like, you know, the cooks always being like, why does he only talk to you? I work really hard.
I was going to say, you're working harder,
you know,
than they were.
And I had fire in my eyes, and, you know, I still will, but... And then Jonathan Gold, who wrote amazing things about my restaurant, who truly celebrated Los Angeles. Not just the big name, the big dollar restaurants, but the, like, and I'm not even going to say mom and pop shops, but the true identity and the nucleus of L.A., the dumpling places, the taco
independence.
Places. Yes. Yeah. Which I am, you know, I'm just a little fish, you know, but he saw me, he saw my food, and he understand from such a deep level on what I was trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
So it was difficult, you know, and now we have new people dictating the narrative, and I think, you know, it's interesting. I'm interested to see where we go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, Yeah, I mean, I didn't know Robichon at all.
Yeah.
I never met Jonathan, weirdly.
Oh, he's just...
But he's, I think most people would probably say, the greatest food writer we've ever had.
My heart flutters when I think about him, how intelligent that man was.
Yeah.
And he would come in my restaurant, and I'd sit with his wife and his son. And I always had him in my mind as a muse, like when I was creating or thinking about a dish, because he's able to articulate in such a way. But about a month before he passed, we sat on a farm dinner, and this chef was cooking a meal under the sunset, and he sat right across from me, and this young lady sat next to him, and we had the most amazing conversation. And for me, I didn't know he wouldn't be there the next month.
Yeah.
But that moment in time, I thought to myself, wow, this is all I ever wanted. His wife was sitting next to me on my right, and he was sitting adjacent from me on my in front of me.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, and we talked about Robichon mashed potatoes.
Uh-huh, sure.
Whether a technique can be essentially copyrighted, and how does that live? And I brought up the Robichon potato, and I said, well, you know, that you say that, and people know that as a technique and can imply, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a chef also.
Yes.
So it's interesting. But we had the most compelling conversation, and I was just enamored. And that lives in the soul.
It's really amazing, isn't it, when you're able to meet somebody you admire that much. And it sounds like this was the case that night. Be comfortable, like, able to just engage them as people. Like, I personally met several times. We weren't close friends, but I met Bourdain several times. And I have to say, if I'm honest, I was always so... And he's probably the only person in the industry I felt like this about. I was too... It was all me. He was great.
Yeah.
But I couldn't... I was like a kid.
Yes.
I was like a kid meeting, you know, like their sports hero.
Yes.
I could barely... I was never able to just hang.
Yes.
You know? So
yes.
I think that's the only reason I didn't get to know him better.
Yes.
But it sounds like when you met Gold and spent that, you know, an extended period of time, it was the opposite of that. That you were able to sort of get to know him a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I wasn't in my chef whites and
yeah.
coming out to...
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
But I always just felt this, like, he was just a real human, you know?
Yeah.
Like he just had this golden... aura
yeah.
about him,
yeah.
you know?
It's great. Well, let's end on that note. That's
yes.
a good note. Okay. Thank you very much.
My
great
pleasure,
meeting
Andrew.
You.
I can talk to you forever.
Oh, well,
man.
Thank you very much. I look forward to eating your food sometime
yeah.
in the future.
I look forward to that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and moving right along, these are going to be quick, Caitlin. I know you want to have your tequila, watch
mm-hmm.
some television.
I really do.
I know. So these are going to be quick.
Okay.
Have you met Barbara Lynch?
No.
Okay, Barbara Lynch.
And I'm from Massachusetts.
That's crazy. I see her all the time.
Yeah, no, I've never seen her. I mean,
anyway.
Not that Massachusetts is like this tiny little place, but I think it's interesting that our paths have not crossed.
All right, well, Barbara Lynch, I always love seeing Barbara. Again, she is someone who has made no bones about the fact that she feels like she could roll me, take me for all I'm worth, leave me in the street in my underwear. And move on with all my money and assets. She really believes she could do that.
I believe she could do
with
that, too.
With Darth Vader-like mental control over me.
Okay.
Nevertheless, I consider her a friend.
That's
anyway,
what's holding her back, Andrew.
Barbara has done so much for restaurants, restaurant culture in the city of Boston. She's a real OG. I adore her. Everything I'm saying is just in good fun. But... yeah, I was glad we were able to make a little time privately to have a little conversation in San Diego, and I hope you enjoy it. Here you go.
So fun to come to cities that you... I've never been to San Diego, so...
Ever?
Never.
Oh, wow.
But now we got a new cute cult following from yesterday.
You were really... I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the fact that you talk in such a kind of direct way. You don't...
Trump-style way?
Trump style?
No, I'm kidding.
In a way, maybe. But you're very direct. I mean, you're very direct. You're a little bit, you don't sit there and agonize over stuff. You don't come off as media trained. I mean, all this is a compliment. But you were flocked with young cooks after
so nice.
The first panel you were on yesterday who were just dying
yeah.
to get your advice.
I mean, but think about it. When we were growing up, I mean... You know, like Ruth Reichel and all those writers. It was just like you get information from them. I mean, I think this. I don't know. I like being direct, and I think that's our job now. We're here to, you know, share what we got, share
yeah.
knowledge.
Yeah.
You just never have enough time to get to all of them.
But all the people who need it.
All the people, like you know. I mean, I think I spent all night long talking to
yeah
people.
Yeah.
Kids.
Yeah.
Not even kids. They're young, you know, young women, young men ready
yeah.
to do their own thing. I think it was nice. It was inspiring for me.
Do you feel, was that there for you coming up? Do you feel like this
know.
Is a
I
new
was so
thing?
I so shy coming up. I didn't talk to anybody.
But do you think even if you talked to people, do you think it would have been there for you?
It wouldn't
you?
Have registered, really. I'm
yeah.
pretty sure. Because it's, I don't know. I think all of my restaurants have never been restaurants. There's no formula. You know, it's a different, I can't follow rules, basically. And
yeah.
And that's why mentoring to me, I feel like, is more like we need to network. We need movements. We need to get going.
Currently.
Yeah, I feel that way.
What
yeah.
do you think we need?
We need movements. I mean.
Yeah, but like what movements? What would be a focus that you think is
I think
needs
the,
addressing?
The mission or the goal would be to get more get our civility back, or like we have a say, and maybe we need to unite or come together. You know, these groups like Women Chefs and Restaurateurs, etc. We need to revamp it. We need to support each other more.
Uh-huh. You're just talking specifically women or just across the board?
Oh, I'm talking all restaurant and hospitality industry.
Yeah.
It's just going to get tougher. Who's going to open... Who's going to have that opportunity to open as many restaurants as I did this day and age?
Right. You mean because of the competition?
No, it's the cities. It's the... I'm sorry. It's the developers... Rent. I mean, it seems like sometimes you never get a break. We were really talking about this last night because if you say you have oxtail on your menu, or so East Coast, but
I'm sure someone's serving oxtail,
you know,
around
point,
here today.
Like, oxtail was $1.99, and then yeah. purveyor seed on your menu, and you're selling it for like $17. It's like, you know, the prices yeah. just go up. Sometimes you get to that point where, fuck, we can never like get ahead.
Right. Right.
And, you know, I think that if there was, like, a fallback or, you know, just support, whether it would be, like, a credit union style, chef's credit union.
Yeah.
You know, to you never want to see anything close. You want to see people succeed. I just wish we had the tools to help them.
Yeah.
Worldwide.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. The business piece, I feel like it's... I'm told there was, I don't know if that happened yet, that there was something like this in development at the CIA, but the business piece is something, you know, so many, it's, one of the things that I love about your, what you do is that it very much operates in this very, I don't even want to, it's beyond old school, it's like a medieval way in terms of like, well, you go on like, you know, cooks go on like a quest for knowledge. That's really how I look at it, you know. Mm-hmm. Even if you go to culinary school, you kind of go, well, what kind of cook do I want to be? What kind of chef? And you find people who can teach you that in a way that you yeah. learned it, you know, 100 years ago.
And they shouldn't jump around, you know, I think master it.
Right, but
it
I mean,
yeah, go ahead.
But the thing very often that's not part of that equation is business, right?
Yeah, no one... Sorry.
It's okay.
My bike ring.
That's all right.
It used to be Jaws.
The theme song?
Yeah.
Well, you should have that. You should have that ringtone for, you know, people you don't want to hear from.
I don't know. My daughter changes it all the time. It's just so funny. This is so funny.
Anyway, but business is very often the piece that's missing.
Yes.
From that pathway, right? Unless right. you're really lucky.
No, that's what I'm... There's that jargon, too, right? So there's a business jargon.
Right.
Basically, oh, well, you're going to get like $1 million for TI.
Right.
It's not free, man.
Yeah.
There's reasons why they take 6% of your sales or whatever.
Yes.
It's a racket, and I feel like even if chefs just got together and we started buying property.
Yeah.
And helping, like, so build New Orleans up. I mean, there's the fucking labor pool in New Orleans. It's amazing.
Yeah.
They just don't have work.
For, yeah.
Like, the starters. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. What's it like in Boston right now in terms of staffing? Are you guys having the same issue that they're having, like, in New York or San Francisco?
We have it everywhere, you know, and it's, we have it everywhere, but yeah. not, I don't think in Boston we just had a really big flux of restaurants close.
Mm. Mm. Everyone seems to have that.
Yeah. But I also feel like it's time, you know?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, like, Frank gave up. I mean, he sold Les Baillets, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I don't know.
All right.
And then Cultivar closed. So there was a little... We have staff. But New England, it's like, oh my God, once summer comes, you know?
Yeah. So... What do you mean? Oh, it's going to be all hell breaks loose.
To yeah, the islands and yeah.
Right. Can we talk about your book for a minute? The last time I interviewed you was over the phone. Your book Out of Line had just come out. You were named like Time Magazine's 100. What was it? 100 most
influential
people. Like 10 minutes before the interview.
Yeah.
And still showed up for the interview, which was impressive.
Give me some credit.
Yeah. I'm convinced it's because my old co-host was a chef. It was just me. Maybe that wouldn't have happened. No. What's the experience of the book been like? Having it out there, I'm sure people must be in touch with you in some fashion with what it, you know, what the experience of reading it was like, and just if I just throw it out there that broadly.
It was, you know, it's I'm going to say cathartic, but it was actually. It's fun to write it. I feel like, what was that, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. You work through it. It's so, once you write it, you think, oh my God, it's over.
Yeah.
I think that, but on the road was really hard because you had to relive it again and again and again. Then you had, it's almost like you have a year for it to settle in. But you still walk around with like sort of, holy shit, like what is going to happen if it goes... You know, if it becomes a show or something.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I'm ready for that. So I always feel like it's good timing for me right now
yeah.
because I look at that as the past, and I'm not living in that world anymore. And
right.
I'm being in that present mode.
Yes.
Which is just a personal growth for myself, which I'm happy about.
Yeah.
But I'm ready. I could write book number two if I want to right now, because what I'm finding now after the first one is that it's just kind of fun to tell your stories.
Yeah.
If it's helpful.
Yeah.
And inspiring.
Yes. You've heard that kind of thing from people, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
You have to have.
Oh, yes.
Having read your book, I think you have to have.
It was so funny when we meet people. What was that? We were sitting at a bar, Via Carota, one night. And
that's a restaurant in the Greenwich Village, New York. Yeah.
So there was this young woman here, and halfway through the dinner, she was solo, and we started chatting. And then all of a sudden, she's like, oh, I'm so-and-so, and I'm so-and-so. And she's like, oh, my God. Like, I just finished your book.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's almost like that school teacher thing. If I can get one good student.
Right. It's all worth it.
Yeah.
So has there been a weirdness to it? Put aside what you just alluded to, which I want to talk about in a second, about the possible film thing.
Mm-hmm.
But is there also a weirdness, though, to have it? I mean, if someone says to you, I've read your book, right? Mm-hmm. They know your life up to a point.
Yeah.
And a lot about it.
I didn't hold back, did I?
No.
No.
Well, you couldn't have. Well, I mean, that's the conversation we had a couple of years ago.
I always go, did I write about the credit cards we used to steal?
Yeah, but yeah. Are you cool with that? Or is it even more than cool? Are you glad that to have it all out, you know, much of a, no pun intended, an open book?
I think I'm cool with that. It settled in. I think it was... for me, it was really hard, exhausting in ways, because I'm more like I'm kind of like an introvert. I am really shy, but when I have to talk, like I'm committed.
Right.
But then when I could go for days and not talk.
Literally.
Yeah.
Like if you're alone,
I'm really shy.
If you're alone and you're aloft and hanging out, you don't feel a need to get on the phone and gab with someone.
I'm a total shit show. I've got like 10 projects going on. You know, but I like it that way.
Yeah. So the book was optioned.
Yes, it was.
Okay, so for people listening, optioned doesn't mean it's happening yet. It means somebody has a lock on the rights for a period of time to do a dramatic adaptation of your book.
Yes.
Okay, and it was Jada's
company Productions
has optioned it.
And they're looking at like Spring Studio. I mean, it's hard to tackle it because we want to probably shop it, you know, not a movie, but a film, like in between The Crown and Shameless. I don't know.
Like a streaming series of some kind.
Yeah. Half an hour.
Like a mini series.
Like
a limited series.
Yeah. So each chapter would be.
Yeah.
Probably have like 2 years there.
Uh huh.
Two or three. I don't know. The second book I want to work on is going to be what my life is like now.
Uh huh.
And believe me, it's crazier. I think it's a little crazier now.
Really?
Than growing up.
How so?
Because some of the shit that happens, it's just like, did that really happen? Like, I don't know, it's
like what? Can you give me a for instance?
A dead guy in my driveway.
What?
That's a chapter, because...
You mean like he went out to get the paper and there was...
No, he was on an oxygen tank and I actually cooked one of the best fucking meals ever. It was like an auction item and he came to my house. There. Three couples or four couples, and this particular guy was on oxygen.
Yeah.
And he made it out to his car. He made it halfway around the driveway, and his wife was like, call 911.
Yeah.
He's not breathing.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I was with Kristen Kish, and we were both like, fuck. We did all, like, we had so much fun, and we cooked Joelle Robuchon style, old school. And then his wife, and I was like, oh my God, I went out to see him, and I was like, did he have any allergies I didn't know of?
Oh, my gosh. God.
He was deader than a codfish. But she texted me from the hospital, and she said, you know, he passed away at 11:54, but he died a happy man. It was one of the best meals of his life.
Aw.
Dead guy in the driveway.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, there's a... Well, whatever. I was just going to say, there's a book I think somebody should write, and it just occurred to me, you'd be a really good person to write it.
But what?
About your industry, but no one's written, I don't believe. We were talking about like mentoring and things earlier. Mm-hmm. I don't think we used that word, but I don't believe any chef with a lot of hard-earned experience has written the business Kitchen Confidential.
Right.
Right?
All that could be juicy.
But also highly informative.
Yeah.
At the exact same time, right? Because it's the juicy things that would be educational.
It's the reality that happens.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, I think it, you're right.
But you
could
do that.
There isn't a book out there.
Yeah.
I mean, the books that are out there are from college, usually. Like,
yeah, they're right. They're hypothetical, non-real world situations.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That don't tell you things like, you know, your contractor may like vanish.
No, you
vanish,
know what you did
or,
when you're getting fucking case studies done on you and like,
right.
from Harvard or Durham,
right.
and they're like, oh, you're going to fail. And I'm like, sure. You know, 20 years later, because I didn't follow your formula.
Right.
So I think, yeah, no, I think it's... It'd be interesting to kind of get a group of chefs together that are independent owners. Like,
yeah.
There's not too many of us that I'm an independent owner. I don't have a company behind me.
Yes.
Lydia Bastianich, I think, is the same, and Suzanne Gowen is the same. So that's pretty good for three females, I think.
Yeah.
And we did it old school, yes.
Yeah.
Like $6 an hour, $4 an hour, if you were going to get paid. I mean, then I used to have to go and beg for my paychecks. Those are little lessons you need. Right, because it's not going to happen again.
Well, that, and then how to smell a bad business deal.
Oh yeah, I mean, get the fucking stars out of your eyes because
like, yeah,
this is you got to think about this as your life.
Yes,
and if this is what you want to do for the next 25 years,
yeah.
then do it.
Yeah. What's your favorite part of your job of being do it whatever it is that you do right now? That's pretty far ranging, right? But what do you really? When are you at your happiest right now, professionally? What is it that you do in all the mix of things you do in mm-hmm. your various projects and restaurants? And
yeah, right now it's fixing the challenges that we're faced with in terms of brick-and-mortar restaurants and, you know, labor costs. And
that's your favorite thing?
I love fixing things.
You like problem-solving?
I do. Oh, problem-solving. There you go. I like that word. I like to
that's what you don't mean mechanically fixing things. You mean solving...
No, there's so many... things I want to get, I got to get out of this
right
to move forward to create more things.
Yes,
but I won't do it until I'm really happy and satisfied that all my restaurants are running and that we're next going on our junior management and young CDCs. Let's shuffle them around, never be complacent. And so it's almost like, and thank God we're busy too, you know, it's
right.
busy, but once they're running and they're great. Then I can move forward with what things I've probably been working on for the last 4 years, but we weren't ready.
Yeah. When you say working on, are these things that just exist in your head, or are these things you've actually actively talked
like,
about with your team?
Not yet. We're here doing a lot of that.
Yeah.
In the next couple of days, major changes. Like, it's not going to be a Band-Aid one. It's just...
Got it.
You get a... Not changing of who I am or what my food is. It's just working on new projects.
Uh-huh.
I can't tell you yet, though.
I'm not asking.
Okay.
I wasn't. Yeah. No, I know when.
Don't
to,
try to get it out.
I know when. I know when to back off. Especially with you, I feel hopelessly square when I talk to you.
Why?
Can I tell you that?
Why?
I do. You don't probably remember this. You and I, when we interviewed you about the book, you made some comment. Like you said to me, "This is my Jimmy Bradley, who I used to do the show with. He thought this was so funny. He said, you said to me something like." Well, I could talk to you now, Andrew, because I know you. And I said, you know what, Barbara? I don't, we've seen each other a few times, but it's always like at a panel thing or a conference. Like, yeah. I don't really feel like we know each other. And you said, no, I mean I know you like I could manipulate you.
Yeah,
that's what you said to me.
I could get anything.
Like, I could get you, I could get it. Right. That's what I mean by feeling square around you.
Come on, Andrew, we're going to go do a drive-by fruiting right now. No, I like...
That's what I mean.
That's the kind of people I love to hang around with. I can get them to do anything.
Yeah.
And then you always have good takeaways the next day. So
yeah.
Life is... You know, I think life is amazing. And I think what I liked yesterday was that what I noticed in that whole audience was they have passion.
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
Do you feel the same way when you go to culinary schools?
Yeah.
Yeah, I
well,
love.
Well, they're so lost though in school.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're like 18. They're young.
Oh, because they're so young.
Yeah, I mean, and I think they're young and they're also nervous about paying back loans. You know, there's a lot of stress on them too when they're that young.
Yeah.
And you're trying to take as much information as you can.
I just, yeah, I don't know. To me, there's just, though, I've never picked that up, but there's such an eagerness. They're so sincere.
Mm-hmm.
They're so, you know, their optimism is unspoiled. But I just, you know, you talk at a culinary school, like you were on a book tour, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've been on a book tour recently. You know what I don't see at culinary school? I don't see people texting when I'm talking.
Oh, that's true.
I don't see people on their on their phones. I don't see people having little whispering side. I see people who really want to know and soak up whatever you can offer them.
Right.
And that's what this feels like.
Imagine learning all day long, but then you can't go home to your little apartment and cook dinner. But if you're in a dorm, you know that must be frustrating. But like I tried to say yesterday, this is the fucking time. This is a really great time. Not only just for chefs and restaurateurs, but for food science. It's a pioneer world out there with edibles. It's changing.
Yeah.
And that's a good change. It's a big change. It's like, in terms of you can take your passion and create whatever you want.
I mean, yeah.
There's a good opportunity for that.
Well, it seems to me there's also more ways than ever to be a chef, right? Like, everyone's talking about how hard the big cities are and how hard staffing can be, but you know, you could also do a food truck. You could also become
Open a kiosk and sell
You could become a pop up chef and travel around and take your show on the road.
I want to do as seen on TV and make everyone else cook. Did you want the hot dog or the roast chicken or the air fried?
But
that'll be $40.
But that's increasingly becoming a real category.
I know.
You know?
And technology, too. I mean, kitchen equipment. It's a great time to... We have, you know, there's talented people in this industry.
Yeah.
Really talented. And they just have to... They have to know it.
Do you feel like you're... having come up when you did, do you feel like you... Like, all the things you just said, I feel like there's people who kind of are very much sort of intimidated and off-put by, like, the new.
No, they're afraid. They're like, oh, my God,
afraid.
This is so needed.
Afraid. That's a good word.
This is so easy. Why hasn't anybody else done it?
But...
It just can't be right.
But so you seem to be very... Start. You're drawn to it still. You seem to have a very youthful attitude toward innovation, new things, change. You seem very much unbothered by it.
It works for me.
Yeah.
And so, like... It's the mind thing, though. You just got to believe in it.
Yeah.
And as wacky as it is, it's probably great. And
yeah.
I think any sort of entrepreneur with a mindset like that would like to do that, too.
Great. All right. Well, I'm sure you want to stop being interviewed and get out there and eat some lunch. So thanks for giving me a half hour of your time.
Thank you, Andrew.
Good to see you.
Great seeing you.
All right, Caitlin, we're moving right along here. This next interview is with Ken Frank. You've not met Ken Frank.
No, but I helped transcribe your book.
Yes.
Do you remember that? We were up at a lake house, and I was like,
book. It was when I was trying to sell the book.
Yes.
I had been doing some interviews. This was a moment in our lives. You were like at a crossroads. You weren't working.
I know, and that's not me at all.
That's not you at all, but you weren't working.
Yeah.
And I had done some interviews with some people who I knew would be in the book, and you volunteered to transcribe them for me.
Yeah. That didn't last long.
No,
I did
you
three
did,
days.
You did a couple. You did Susan Feniger, you did Ken Frank, you did Michael McCarty.
Yep. And I loved Ken. I remember, like, when I was transcribing the stuff, I kept going, like, this is a great interview.
Well, here's what I love about Ken Frank. First of all, he's really found a home for himself. He's been at this restaurant, Latoque, which was originally a Los Angeles restaurant. He sort of became disenchanted with L.A. We talk a little bit about it in the interview. Moved to Napa, and he's just, like, found this perfect space for himself, and he's very happy. His wife's amazing. He's just a happy dude, you know. He's comfortable.
Well, he lives in Napa.
No, but it's more than that. He's comfortable in his own skin, and he's very open about the kind of guy he was when he was very young. He was sort of known as an enfant terrible in Los Angeles back in the 70s, as most people would be. If you were like 21 and you were a famous American chef before there was such a thing in L.A., in the 70s, I think it would go to your head, too.
Mm-hmm.
Ken's very open about all that. Unlike a lot of people, he doesn't try to sugarcoat it or BS his way out of it. He's just very frank about his learning curve and
I really like Ken a lot. Anyway, this is he was on a panel we did about my book there, and then we've sat down and we did a private interview, which I think is very much typifies Ken's personality. I think you'll get a real sense of him. So anyway, with that, here you go. Me and Ken Frank recorded at the Chef's Roll Anti-Convention in San Diego.
We're in a borrowed space. We're squatting at Chef's Roll. Can you just tell me, though, this is something I didn't know about you. We were doing the sound check, and you said you had radio in your past?
When I was in L.A., I had a one-minute radio show 5 days a week on the jazz station, which later became the classic station, called Ken Frank Chef's Tips. It was sponsored by supermarkets, and they ran the show every day at 11:30 when people were beginning to get hungry. And it was a lot of fun, and it taught me how to write, because when you write a minute of radio to open, develop, hook, and close in 59 and a half seconds, it takes a little practice.
You did all that yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Now, back in that day, you wouldn't have had a publicist.
No.
How did that? Do you remember how it happened? Did you have some customer who was like in the radio business?
Well,
or the supermarket business?
Originally, the podcast, it was a one-minute show that they had Ruth Reichel doing.
Oh my God.
But when she left Los Angeles to move to New York,
yeah,
to take over the spot at the New York Times,
yeah,
and the LA Times, the owner of the radio station, Saul, was a friend of mine, and he asked me if I would take it over. And I did it for about 3.5 years.
Oh my God.
So I'd go in once a week and tape 5 one-minute pieces.
Okay. Which
I wrote myself. Yeah, and you learn to use bigger fonts and double-space,
yeah,
it, and you practice it.
Yeah.
And with a little practice, it's...
So you treated it very, yeah, seriously.
Oh, yeah. I still have probably 300 or 400 scripts.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. All right, Ken. So we, obviously, you and I know each other through my book. You're one of the gentlemen on the cover of the book. But even though I tell your story in some detail, I'd love for people to hear it from you. You grew up near the city of Los Angeles, but not in Los Angeles proper. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you grew up, what your folks did, and that fateful time overseas?
So I grew up in San Marino. I grew up in the house that was built to raise my dad in, that he grew up in. And my earliest memories of cooking are actually with my grandfather on my mom's side, because I would often spend weekends at their house, and he taught me how to weld, he taught me about electricity, and he taught me how to, develop film in a darkroom. He was this amazing guy. He's the reason I still fix all of the equipment in the kitchen, because it's just, I've been fixing things as long as I can remember. But he was also a really good cook. And he'd grown up on a farm in the San Fernando Valley, near where the Burbank studios are now, in the 1890s, when there were two farms out there and one road, and it was a dirt road. And so when I spent weekends at my grandparents' house, we'd get up early and we'd make breakfast. And we would almost always make pancakes, but he didn't make pancakes. He made flapjacks. And if you don't know what flapjacks are, those are pancakes that you flip up in the air and you catch them in the pan. And when you're 7 or 8 years old, that's pretty frickin' magical.
Now, wait a minute. But does that affect the end result?
Who knows? So those are when your grandfather can flip a pancake,
yeah,
in the air and catch it in the,
yeah,
pan.
Yeah.
He's the best,
right,
thing ever.
Right.
So I've always loved food. I've always liked to eat. I didn't grow up in a house that ate particularly well. But when I was 15, my parents were both teachers at a very prestigious private school in Pasadena, and one of the school's very, very generous benefactors had given them a large grant of money, the proceeds of which were to be used to fund one teacher per year to live off the North American continent, with the goal over time of making a more worldly faculty, which is a very noble goal. So in 1972, my dad won the second Dudley Wright grant and moved my entire family, I'm the oldest of five, moved all seven of us to the village of Ivoire on the French side of Lake Geneva, about half an hour outside of Geneva. It's a village of 307 people, this 16th century village that is a national monument, where you were either a steamboat captain, a fisherman, or a hotel keeper. I went to French public school, had an awesome French girlfriend who's still a friend to this day.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. And I desperately wanted to stay. And so my parents said, well, get a job and you can stay. Same day, found a family to live with and got a job as a dishwasher. So family moved back, and I spent what would have been the year between my 10th and 11th grade years in high school working, starting as a dishwasher. And after about 6 weeks, because I work hard, they gave me the choice of moving into the dining room essentially as a busboy or the kitchen as a slave. It's like, no, I'm going in the kitchen because I've got to learn how to make this food, because if I go home to hamburgers, I'm going to starve.
Yeah. So question for you. You mentioned that flapjack thing, right? Now, you mentioned, you know, you always kind of liked food. But, you know, that whole, you talking about flipping that pancake in the air, right? That also speaks to something I think a lot of people end up cooking like, which is the finesse of cooking, I don't want to say anything that might sound derogatory, because I don't mean it that way, but, you know, when people start getting really good with a knife, you know, how fast you can go. You know, some kitchens, people have, like, little competitions on the spur of the moment. Was there an element of that that appealed to you, like, of mastery of, you know, the mastery of craft, of the ability to sort of, you know, as they used to say, impress your friends?
Well, there is a certain satisfaction when you do something you love to do, and when you really master it and it becomes natural, it becomes easy. You know, cooking is not hard. It is not rocket surgery. It's lots and lots and lots of practice. And you have to love what you do. It has to be what you want to do.
Do you believe that's true for any? Do you think anyone can learn how to cook?
No, because I know for a fact that some people simply cannot learn how to cook. Mm-hmm. They're rare, but they do exist. A few of them have tried to work in my kitchen, and you quickly realize, wow, they're just never good. And you can tell very quickly, even if someone doesn't have a lot of experience, and even if someone is not a very good cook yet, when someone is going to be a good cook, they take to it very easily. They learn quickly. The way they hold things, the way they do things, it's comfortable to them. It's second nature to them. And we get, you know, young cooks come in with very little experience, but who have that kind of talent. And within a couple of weeks, we've got them going down the road of learning, and it's really great to see. And sometimes, it's, you know, after 6 weeks, you go, wow, not gonna happen.
Yeah. Is that hard for you?
No. It's just
you feel like
is.
You're almost doing them a favor?
Oh, you know, lots of people want to be cooks,
right.
And I think it's really important, especially for young people today. You know, people ask me all the time, my son wants to be a chef, will you talk to him? And my advice is always get a job. Don't talk about what culinary school you're going to go to. It's way too early for that. Get a job. Make sure you love working in a restaurant. It doesn't even have to be a good restaurant. Any restaurant is fine. A better restaurant is better, but just get a job in a restaurant. Start working 40-plus hours a week. Start working Friday night and Saturday night while your friends are out having a good time for a little money with people likely yelling at you. If you're born to cook, you will quickly realize, this is what I got to do. And then if this is what you got to do, if you want to spend your parents' money and go to culinary school, go ahead. But chances are you'll realize that, like myself and like so many others, just keep working. Work in good restaurants. Work hard. Keep learning. Get paid to learn how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
Because I see so many people go to culinary school, and then they graduate, and they go, okay, I'm a chef now. No way. You're not even close. And it takes a long time. They've got a lot of debt. I mean, I have a sous chef that worked for me for about 8 years. He started working for me up in Rutherford after he had done like a 6-month stage out of culinary school in Las Vegas, working for a very famous chef who shall remain nameless, where he had been essentially just forced to peel potatoes and peel vegetables for 8 hours a day because he was cheap labor. But this is a kid who was a great cook, superhuman. But, you know, he worked for me for 8 years. He ended up graduating out the very top of the kitchen because he had worked every station, and he'd run it, and he's awesome. But he had to pay off, like, $50,000 worth of debt, and he was making $15 an hour. You know, so it helps that he's disciplined, and he got there because he might sock away $400 a month, $400 a month, $400 a month. But that's hard to do, and that's, he could have learned just as much working for me for 8 years as he could have by going to culinary school
and
getting a bunch of debt. Because, you know, this is so many young cooks burn out and aren't doing this by the time they get into their early 30s that it's a shame to invest all of your 20s in something that's not going to work for you unless you've already determined early on that this is what you've got to do.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the early days in L.A. because you really were, this is long before Michael's comes along, you in your early 20s were a known quantity in Los Angeles, a known chef at a time when there were very few American chefs of any renown. I believe personally, and I just would love your take on it. I mean, first of all, you had the chops, but also, you know, you're one of the few people of this era that we would not call a career changer. You discovered the kitchen and committed to the kitchen earlier than a lot of people, you know, that were sort of within a couple of years of your age.
So, yeah, I started cooking the summer I was 16. And then when I came back to the U.S., went to high school for my 11th grade year, I worked at a local ski resort on the weekends slinging hamburgers to make the money to go back to France because, one, I had such a great time living over there, you know, with this family and working and, you know, being essentially emancipated as a teenager, which was great. So I've been working, you know, when I came back from my senior year, I got a job after school in a really good French restaurant in Pasadena. So I've been working full-time since I was in high school. And originally it was, you know, I figured this is great because I'm making money. Now I can pay for college. Because originally I wanted to be a doctor or a marine biologist. And I could still do the marine biology thing. And, you know, I indulged my inner Jacques Cousteau with my reef aquarium tank. But, you know, it wasn't going to be a career until I went to UC Irvine. You know, I was working then in a really great restaurant in Newport Beach. Because wherever I went, I ended up working in the best restaurant. And that's an interesting thing that, you know, an 18 or 19-year-old kid who mostly just spoke French and knew how to make soup could get a job working in almost any restaurant at the time. But once I started college, it's like, no, I'm working to put myself through college, and I like the work better than I like college, and I think this might be a viable career. And it was really, really lucky that the time that I thought this might be a viable career was, in fact, the very, very beginning of when that was true.
In this country?
In this country.
What gave you the confidence in that? I mean, you'd been to France, right? So you had seen the Nouvelle Cuisine thing happening.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
But was that, did you think, oh, that's eventually going to seep into the U.S.?
Paul Bocuse was my idol.
Yeah.
Freddy Girardet, who had just started to become known, was my idol. And that's who I wanted to be.
Right, but did you believe it was inevitable that something like that would happen here with chefs getting more well-known? And
I didn't.
Was it just an instinct?
I don't think any of us thought that chefs would become the celebrities that they are today at that time. But I certainly felt very strongly that it was a new age where being a chef was, in fact, a reputable thing to do and an interesting, exciting, you know, intellectual pursuit as well, something that could be, in fact, noble. Even a few years earlier, being a cook would have been considered a very low-class job, and being a chef would have been considered a dead end. Restaurants were still always owned by owners and not usually by chefs in this country. So I was literally in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. So when you talk about, you know, wherever you went, you ended up, you know, working in the best kitchens, right? There was a dearth of really good cooks around. When I hear about guys like you, I almost imagine like old gunslingers or something, you know, that you could sort of, not like hitmen, but, you know, someone who kind of strolls into town, I heard you're looking for a few good people, and, you know, could sort of, it seemed like a highly marketable skill in a very finite group of places.
Well, it is still a highly marketable skill. As Barbara said during our little talk earlier today,
Barbara Lynch,
you know, when she started cooking, her main goal was, if I'm a cook, I'm always going to find work. I was never unemployed for more than 2 or 3 days at a time. It was never hard finding a job. And, you know, with the job market today, any cook who wants to work is working, and if they don't, they're lazy and they shouldn't be.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a cook's market today.
But you know, back in the 70s, it speaks to the level of cuisine that was accepted as good then versus now. And this is something you alluded to in the talk earlier today as well. The level of knowledge, the level of experience that cooks in this country have today versus 40 years ago is absolutely phenomenal. The fact that when I was 18, I spoke fluent French. I knew how to work in a kitchen, so I could hustle with the best of them. I knew how to make, you know, vinaigrette and mayonnaise from scratch. I had just learned how to make beurre blanc. I could pronounce the names of all the vegetables. I could get things out of the refrigerator. I had some butchering skills. I had phenomenal fish filleting skills because I paid rent for 2 summers in France filleting fish in the basement of the house where I lived. But that I could speak French and make 20 dishes, well, hire this kid. He's great.
Yeah, that was it.
And that would not be enough today.
Yeah.
And I was just really, really lucky to start when I did. And I learned along with everybody. I just learned as I went. I'm a far better chef than I am 40 years now on than I was when I was 21. But when I was 21, I was serving kind of the best food in L.A. And mm-hmm. when I look back at that, it's like, wow.
Yeah. So can we talk? Can we just talk briefly? In L.A., you're one of these. You're one of the few Americans. You're probably the only one at the time who was as known as you were. You also were sort of known as the term that came up a lot, including in the press, was enfant terrible, right? You were known as a bit of a hothead.
I got the name enfant terrible. I earned it.
I'm only bringing this up because you've been very open with it with me on the record before.
First of all...
But I think it is interesting because you exhibited some of the behavior that chefs became notorious for at the time.
I made the L.A. Times when I was 21 years old. People called me the Mozart of the stockpots. I made L.A. Magazine, California Magazine. I made the New York Times when I was 21 years old. And, you know... getting a lot of media attention when you're really young is not always really healthy. And getting a lot of media attention before I was savvy about how the media works meant that when someone would interview me, I would just tell them what I thought. So I would tell them, for example, that restaurant owners were notoriously ripping off their staff, that restaurant owners were notoriously serving frozen fish but calling it fresh. And that did not sit well with the established restaurant community. Who is this kid? Where did he come from? Who the fuck is he? And why is he saying them? In retrospect, I was right. I was telling the truth, but I hadn't yet learned that sometimes it's better to say something off the record as background so a journalist can understand what's going on, but maybe not be quoted. Sometimes there's some value to not saying something if you can't say something nice. It took me a while to learn that. It took me a long time to lose that reputation. But at the end of the day, there wasn't anything that I said that wasn't true. It was what I thought. And most of the time, I was actually right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think anyone disputes most of that stuff. But it is interesting what you say, because this was a time... I mean, you were more than a decade pre-internet. This was a time when, there was the term going viral. That didn't exist. So there wasn't...
How fortunate.
No, but I mean, these days, even children grow up because of, social media and whatnot. You develop very young a sense of what you say and do when there are recording devices present, which is most of the time, right? There was nothing like that back then. You're 1 minute, you're in a kitchen... in complete privacy, someone comes in with a recorder, you sit at a table, there's no one's tweeting things out, no one's Instagramming things out, nobody's going on Facebook. I could see how one back then especially would have no idea.
It took me a few years to learn that you have to be careful what you say to the press.
Yeah.
Not that you're worried about saying something that's not true, it's just you have to be careful that what you say may be misinterpreted by people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lesson well learned.
So I personally love Los Angeles very much. You did really well there. You were at a couple of restaurants. You were, as I've talked about before, the opening chef at Michael's. You move on. You open La Toque. But you became disenchanted with the Los Angeles, at least of the time. I don't know that that would happen to you today with what's going on there. But what was it that kind of pushed you personally to want to migrate somewhere else?
Well, the thing about Los Angeles in the 80s and the 90s and certainly into the early 2000s was that it became a city that was very much more focused on social status than culinary status. The best restaurants in New York were the restaurants that were serving the best food, period. And they were full of famous people. The most famous restaurants in Los Angeles were the ones that were full of stars.
Right.
And it was who you got your picture taken with. It was what table you got. It was all about celebrity. And
these status.
Celebrity and status.
Yeah.
And these people didn't give a fuck about food. They just wanted to be famous. And so when you've got this really strong Hollywood culture where, you know, they have to be beautiful, they have to be famous, you know, they all want no salt, they all want no fat, they all want no sugar. You know, I would have customers come in and ask me in January if I could make fettuccine cake. And I'd say,
which
well,
is what, for people who don't
it's
know?
It's a fettuccine with fresh tomatoes and a few other things. But the key is, why would you ever make that in January or February when you don't have fresh tomatoes? And I tell them, yeah, I can. Well, why won't you? Well, because one, it's not an Italian restaurant. And two, it's January, and they're not the right tomatoes. And people get all upset. It's like, well, but that's what I want. Then go to an Italian restaurant. That's not what I have on my menu. It's not what I do. I can make it, but I'm not going to.
So you, it is funny, you know, there are these scenes in movies, right? Like the one that comes to mind for me is the movie Get Shorty, where Danny DeVito, you know, every time he goes into a restaurant, sort of customizes his meal, right? And there's a lot of stuff in the player about, you know, I want my water in a wine glass.
Oh, that is so L.A.
But those, for people who, and anyone from L.A. who's listening, you know I love L.A. It's probably my favorite city. I think about spending a part of my time there when my children moved to college. But at that time, in that place, those scenes, those are not really parody. That was basically true to life. Those were things that happened almost verbatim.
Those were things that happened literally every day.
Yeah, but I mean, the examples in those movies, those are not exaggerations.
No. Those were written by screenwriters who saw them for real
yeah.
and knew that they were, in fact, the truth.
Yeah.
And I just got really tired of that. And I was drawn to Napa because it was somewhere I wanted to live. It was somewhere that had a really, the Bay Area had a really great, and I found really honest culinary scene,
mm-hmm.
really great products. People would try anything, eat anything, and I was really drawn to that, and that's why I moved to Napa. It's certainly the smartest thing I've ever done. But let me talk about what does make Los Angeles so great. I think in terms of ethnic diversity, I don't know that there's a city on the planet that can even touch Los Angeles. It has undoubtedly some of the best Chinese food outside of China. It has undoubtedly some of the finest Japanese food outside of Japan. And the ethnic diversity, the sheer range of ethnic foods that are available in LA at a very high level of mastery, just no city anywhere competes with it. And that riotous array of all of this crazy stuff that's available in LA is really magical.
Mm. Agreed. So, you move up to Napa. You've been there for a while.
20 years.
I met you for the first time we had done, I think, a phone interview once, but I came to interview you, I think it was in 2014. We met in the morning in the dining room of La Toque, which doesn't, at least at the time, it didn't do lunch. So we had the place where nobody was there. It was you and me. You seemed to me then, and in the few times I've seen you since that, like a very And it may be stronger than this, but I'm just going to use the word I feel very safe with about my impression. You seemed like a very contented person.
I love what I do.
But you also seem to love where you do it, how you're doing it. You seem like you really found the sweet spot for yourself.
You know, I love what I do, and I get to do what I do on my own terms.
Meaning what?
I love this business. I love cooking. I love restaurants. I love wine. I love where I live. And, you know, I'm my own boss. I get to do what I want to do on my own terms every day, and that's really hard to beat.
That's great. But when you say on your own terms, what makes it on your own terms? You're cooking the food you want to cook?
It's where I want to cook. It's what I want to cook. It's who I want to cook for.
Mm-hmm.
It's when I want to cook. It's 10 minutes from home. It's a beautiful place. I love my job.
Yeah. What do you still do? I haven't been there in several years. If I'm remembering right, I think the menu was it in four quadrants?
So,
and you could sort of decide the number of courses you wanted and kind of...
We have a set vegetable tasting menu that we do every night.
Okay.
We have a 9-course chef's table tasting menu that we do every night.
Chef's table, meaning
chef's
in the kitchen?
Menu. Well, but that menu is available everywhere.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Our core menu is divided into 4 groups of dishes,
yeah,
3 or 4 each. And that's where people can put together their own tasting menus. Kind of a unique format.
So you can do a 2-course plus dessert. You could do 3, 4.
You can do 3 or 4 plus dessert.
Okay.
And you can do them really in any order you want. They're ordered. They're organized in order pretty much by the wine pairings that they go with. Because everything on our menu has wine paired with it. Because Latoque, since I've moved to Napa, I have focused on making it really a wine-driven restaurant because I can't think about what I'm going to eat or what I'm going to cook without thinking about what are we going to go pull it out of the cellar to drink with it. So the first grouping is lighter, brighter whites.
Mm.
The second grouping is usually richer whites, though there are exceptions to this. The third grouping would be thin-skinned and medium-bodied reds, and then the fourth grouping, which tends to be protein-based meat courses, tends to be thicker-skinned reds with some age on them.
Mm. Has it always been that way in terms of the organization?
Yep.
So even when I first came there, that was like 10 years ago now.
It makes a lot of sense for people to order something from the first group, the second group, the third group, and the fourth group.
Yeah.
But we have people order all 3 from the fourth group sometimes.
Mm.
It doesn't really bother me. It's just
sure. There's
a certain order to it that makes sense.
Yeah.
But we want you, hey, if that's how you want to do it,
yeah,
thank you for coming.
Yeah. So what are some of the unique, I mean, you just mentioned the wine, how wine factors into the organizing of the menu. That's probably one answer. But you were in American wine country there. How does that affect how you do what you do? What are some things maybe that for someone who hasn't lived or operated a restaurant in that area, how does that influence your decision making?
Well, what's good about it is the sheer number of people who visit there that are focused on what we do. There's a large number of well-to-do visitors that are there to celebrate life, to celebrate their success, to spoil themselves with some great wine and food and stay in a beautiful hotel and visit some wineries and eat in some great restaurants. So we have a visitor market that is really focused on what we do well, and we have lots of places for them to do it. So we have this core group of visitors that's really fantastic. The thing we have to be careful of is not to get sucked into this. A lot of places end up getting sucked into this. Well, if it's not from here, it's not any good. And I long ago decided that, you know, we don't care where the wine comes from as long as it's good. Napa Valley is home to some wines that belong on the world's best tables, there's no doubt. But should we be drinking Grüner Veltliner and Riesling from Napa Valley? Maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be drinking Pinot Noir from Burgundy? Absolutely. Should we be drinking Barolo when it's truffle season? Absolutely. And when we're eating steak, yeah, we're going to drink some awesome Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon.
Mm-hmm. You, am I correct about this, Ken? You seem to me, unless I'm mistaken, and if it's something you can't talk about, that's fine, but You're not really you're not looking to expand. It seems to me you're shaking your head no as I ask. So here's my question: at a time when a lot of people are, including people of your generation, you know, still looking to consultancies or you know continuing to build their empires, what for you beyond just the love of the game, right? What keeps you? How do you keep yourself engaged? How do you set goals for yourself? How do you set challenges for yourself and, you know, 20 years on in one place?
Well, the challenge in this business is to keep learning and to keep growing. And you just can't stand still. So I travel quite a bit. We don't have any rules on the menu. The menu evolves constantly. And in fact, you know, if you look back 5 years, I look at dishes we were doing, it's like, wow, we did that then? Oh, I'd never do that now.
Yeah.
So it's about relentlessly, it's such an exciting business, and it's such a great time to be a cook in America, and in fact, a cook anywhere in the world. The world is just eating better than ever before, and there's a mixing of Spanish and Italian and Asian, you know. Go to England. London has fantastic restaurants. When I started cooking, no one would ever go to London to eat.
Or England. It was a punchline. British food was a punchline.
Oh, London is a fantastic food town.
Yeah.
Tokyo, Hong Kong, fantastic food town. So the whole world has this really great energy around great eating. There's never been a better time to be cooking. But it also means that you're either learning and staying current and trying new things and seeing what everybody else is doing and learning from all of them and incorporating all of these things that you see into who you are.
Mm.
And that, to me, is really the most exciting thing. To be able to have a restaurant, you know, in my 60s that is hopefully as relevant as my restaurant when I was in my 20s is quite an accomplishment.
It's no small thing.
And it's really fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's great to see you. Thank you for doing this. This is semi-spur of the moment, but it's great to have you on. It was great to be on stage with you
today.
Good
to be here.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, a leading specialty food importer and distributor servicing the New York tri-state area and beyond from coast to coast. I'm Jordan Werner Berry, the host of Modernist Breadcrumbs here on HRN. When it comes to freshly baked artisan bread, it's key to pair it with butter that's made with the same amount of care and attention. And you don't have to go all the way to France to find truly amazing butter. Bourmont 83% is an American butter made using traditional French methods. It's produced by a dairy cooperative in New England. And as a Vermont native, I love that this delicious butter is made locally by family farms. Bourmont 83% is great for cooking, baking, and serving on your table with fresh breads and artisan cheeses. It's proudly distributed by Paris Gourmet to restaurants and grocery stores around the tri-state area. Learn more about Paris Gourmet and all of their gourmet savory foods and pastry ingredients at parisgourmet.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Damon Bolte.
And I'm Souther Teague.
Together we host The Speakeasy, a show where we discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe.
Yeah, our guests range from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, hippies and homebrewers, and every expert enthusiast in between.
Browse episodes of The Speakeasy wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
We are back from our break. I've grouped these last two interviews because these two chefs, Claudette Zepeda Wilkins and Francisco Magoya, both of Mexican descent. Claudette's based in San Diego. She has a restaurant called El Jardin, The Garden. Francisco is part of the Modernist Cuisine organization, but they did a dinner the day after the Chef's Roll event at Claudette's restaurant. So I'm making them the last two interviews. Claudette was someone I never met before. Years ago, she worked for my buddy Gavin Kazin.
Hmm.
Yeah, when he was in his San Diego days. She's been on Top Chef. Some people may know her from the show. I didn't watch the season she was on. Apparently, she sort of found herself in the role of, like, the villain.
It happens.
They do that on reality TV. She's the least villainous person I've ever met. Anyway, we had a great talk about cultural identity, about finding your voice, you know, on the plate, about getting through hard times, as she did. She was not someone of privilege. She was someone who really wanted a life in the professional kitchen and made a lot of sacrifices and did a lot of hard work and worked multiple jobs until she got to this place that she occupies now, which is wonderful. She's very open. We had a great conversation. I'm not going to say anything else about it because this is a long show. I'm just going to turn it over to my interview with Claudette Zepeda Wilkins of El Jardin Restaurant. I hope you enjoy it. San Francisco forever, a lot of play. LA's having its big moment right now. San Diego. It does
the version of the flyover city. The flyover
of California. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or the drive-by, I guess. I have to be honest. The only times I've been to San Diego in the past is there's a like a spa resort I've been to in Baja, Rancho La Puerta.
Yeah.
And
one of my mentors is the chef there, Denise Roa.
Has she been there for a couple of years?
Yeah.
She's really good.
Yeah.
I hadn't been there in 20 years.
Wow.
And I went there 2 summers ago, and the food was the best I'd ever had. But San Diego, you know, I've only come through here on my way there, if I'm honest. You're only a couple hours drive from L.A. if you do it at a smart time of day.
Yeah.
What for you, what's it like cooking here? What do people not understand about this city?
I mean, I've only ever cooked in San Diego.
Yeah.
I had children very young, so I've kind of been landlocked to San Diego, but I don't find that to be a disadvantage. We're a border town.
Yep.
So a lot of our food here is just a mashup of all the immigrants that have been in this region geographically. And it's beautiful. I mean, Baja was just recognized as an actual region. And I was born in San Diego and raised in between Tijuana and Guadalajara. My parents are, you know, I'm first generation, so my parents are from Jalisco and Tijuana.
Yeah.
And it just makes my life have all these beautiful characters that have kind of come in and out throughout my life. And the flavors are bold. The flavors are acid, spice, salt. And, you know, no holding back. And I think that that's a beautiful way that you can eat everything. You can surf, snowboard, and hike all the same day in San Diego. You know, and that's what people come here for, R&R, to unplug, a staycation.
Yes. Yeah.
But we're more than that. We're a solid, you know, food scene now. I feel
it
like...
It feels like it's on the... Like, things are really elevating quickly here.
Yeah. I feel it.
Yeah.
I hope.
So can I just ask, you were born in this area.
Mm-hmm.
You just rattled off a couple of cities in Mexico with an accent that is spectacular. I grew up with a Cuban stepmother.
Uh-huh.
Tell me how you, when you were growing up, did you grow up?
Second language.
You grew up bilingual and English was, Spanish was first.
Yeah, Spanish was first. I learned English watching KPBS, watching Jacques and Julia. I'm surprised I don't have a really weird accent because of the TV we watched as kids.
Okay.
But yeah, Sesame Street. We were learning English the same time my parents were. Or my dad came to the States when he was right out of university to LA in the 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
But my mom learned English with us. So I speak Spanish fluently because I was not allowed to speak English at my home.
Well, why was that? Was it the
grandmother?
Yeah. Or was it the classic heritage, like wanting to hold on to that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, so there's two different sides to first gen, second gen. It's either your family says ignore the past, we're American, you know, and then you don't learn any Spanish. And I have a lot of friends that are that. And on the opposite, my dad was is incredibly proud to be Mexican. So in our household, we were not Mexican-American. We were just Mexican. We just happened to be born here. But I was sent to Mexico every break we had. I lived in Guadalajara with my aunt half of my life until my teenage years.
Yeah.
So Mexico was very prevalent in my life and played a huge role into the person I became.
Was there ever a point in your life... Becoming, that's better. Right, we all are, right?
We're still a work in progress.
If you have your head screwed on, right? Was that ever, I don't know, what is the word, confusing? Was it ever to be here, spend some part of the year south of the border? Like, was that tough?
It was.
Like, psychologically?
It was. I mean, I didn't experience racism until we moved to the States, you know, and we moved from Tijuana to Imperial Beach, which is the you know, most southernest beach in California, right before the border. And it was during the skinhead movement. And that was a really big thing. And there was skinheads in my middle school and, you know, people calling us derogatory terms when I was a child. So it was this culture shock of like, oh shit, we're not, like, at that point it was still a territorial thing of like, you're brown, I'm not, you're wrong, I'm not.
Yeah.
And it was
culture shock, to say the least.
Yeah.
But I think it, you know, I wear Doc Martens every day, and it's kind of like a fuck you to every single person that, you know, that punk movement. I appreciate it, but it got skewed into this awful thing from, you know, from what it was in the UK to what we made it.
Yeah.
It became a very ugly thing, so it was very confusing as a child to say, oh, we are different.
Yeah.
And that was like, what I eat at home isn't what my friends eat at home.
Yeah. Can you talk to me about that a little? What kind of, what did you grow up eating?
I grew up eating, we were poor. My dad was an attorney, a self-employed attorney, which is, I mean, like a starving artist.
Yes.
You know, he took odd jobs, got paid cash. Sometimes he would get paid a restaurant, and my parents, he'd run that to the ground because he wasn't a great businessman. And
right.
What that meant was at home we had, one day we would have rice and beans. We'd have rice and beans for a week. We have fideo, which is, you know, some angel hair with tomatoes, like a soup. And then another day my dad would come home and he'd got paid and he would want, you know, squid and crab. And my mom would have to, he immigrated to L.A. when it was, you know, haute cuisine was this huge thing. So he had a good palate. We just didn't have the money for it.
Uh-huh.
So we would have these influx of money come in and at our house. So we'd have escargot. I had escargot when I was 5, living in TJ. My mom had never cooked before she met my father. And she learned to cook through magazines and Julia Child's cookbooks and the shows. And
so when you say escargot, you're talking about the classic French pepper with the garlic butter.
Yeah, exactly.
And
my dad would find, you know, and it was canned. I mean, it's very hard. I mean, obviously not fresh.
Yeah.
But we were
might have been safer in those days.
Yeah, exactly. But we were exposed to such diversity when I was a child. I didn't think it was different. But, you know, when it was a school lunch thing, we would go to school with a burrito, a machaca burrito, a really small machaca burrito, and, you know, rice and beans or sometimes potato soup. And so, I mean, again, all these layers help me become who I am. And as a mom, I make sure my kids have these same flavors so then they can kind of reflect in their adulthood of the same roots that I had.
When you were eating that food at school, did people find that?
It was
unusual?
Our elementary school in Imperial Beach was also segregated by, they called it tracks.
Uh-huh.
So there was A, B, C, and D tracks.
Yeah.
We were in B because we were bilingual.
Okay.
So in my classroom, we only spoke Spanish.
Oh, my God.
So we also, there was a new playground and an old playground, and track B could only play in the old playground.
Yeah.
So it was this, I guess it's the place we were living in at the time, but all my friends were Mexican. You know, it wasn't until middle school and high school that I started having American friends and really seeing, like, oh, we are different. You know, but we eat that. The first time I saw meatloaf or a casserole, I was like, what is that?
Yeah.
Tuna casserole. It was just a revelation to me. And they're like, it's awful. And I'm like, no, it's great. It's not rice and beans.
Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
You responded to all that stuff, okay?
Yeah. I mean, I loved it. I loved something different.
Yeah. So when did you start thinking about going this route that you've gone? Was it always what you wanted to do?
No. Well, as a child, you know, I was really good at school. I'm a really good student. I'm always reading. I love to read, love to learn.
Yeah.
I think, feel like I'm an eternal student of life. And
learning
and reading for me is just kind of an escape, you know?
Yep.
It's like it's a makeup world. If you read fiction, it's just this beautiful scenario you can play in your head. And as a child, I wanted to be an attorney. I wanted to be a corporate lawyer. I was really good at arguing, and I saw my father would come home with, you know, these briefs that my mom would type up for him. She was his secretary. So my parents would promise me something or say I could do something, and I would write a legal brief and make them sign it. So, but again, I always cooked because I lived in a very old school house. My dad was born in 1937. So the roles were very black and white. I was the only girl.
Okay.
And my brothers took out the trash. I cleaned and helped my mom cook.
Okay.
It was very
traditional.
Traditional, yeah. So for me, cooking wasn't necessarily a job. It was more of like, well, this is what we do because we're women.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to keep the house.
Right.
And it was until I got much older, you know, in high school, that I started feeding my brothers and his friends. And I remember these feelings of watching people cook and like what I made.
Yeah.
And it fed my soul in a way that nothing had really. I mean, you can go to school, but I hated classes that were talking about legal jargon and political science. It just put me to sleep.
Yeah.
So I'd go home and cook.
Yeah.
And,
so when did what was the break point? When did you decide to shift gears?
Well, if Food Network was a thing. It was becoming a thing.
Yeah.
And I started seeing, I didn't know chefs were a thing. I didn't know that was a career.
Right.
I had never been exposed to chefs. I'd only had been exposed to the cooks at my aunt's restaurant that were women that, you know, cocineras tradicionales, we call them. And I thought, well, maybe there's something to this. And I started looking up culinary schools, and my son was born. And it was one of those moments where, how do you tell someone to chase their dreams? How do you basically give this little human inspiration to follow their dreams? So I wrote an essay about Julia Child teaching me how to speak English. And, yeah, I got into culinary school and started that path.
Okay.
So it took me a bit, but yeah. I dropped out. I couldn't afford culinary school. So yeah. I just found good mentors.
Okay.
And that has been, you know, my saving grace, is people that kind of push my head when I turn sideways. They go, nope, keep going forward.
Okay. Is this right? Did you work for Gavin Kazin?
Yeah, I was his pastry chef when he was here in San Diego.
Okay.
And to this day, he's one of my greatest friends and mentors. And
okay. We have some history. I don't know. You may know that. But I wrote the book about the book Whose Door, and he was like my guardian angel. he was the one who made sure I got where I needed to get to do what I needed to do.
Yeah, he was San Diego's wonder kid.
Yeah, right. He was really young.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about how you've kind of... how do you describe what you do? How do you describe your food?
My food.
If you even...
It's hard.
I'll qualify by saying some chefs I know don't like to describe it. They just say, this is my food.
Right. No, I mean, I think my food has a voice. My food is... I like to say that it is the past, present, and future.
Mm.
You know, I like to say it's where I've been, where I'm going, and where I plan, where I see myself going.
Yeah.
And it's always lend itself to being fluid. You know, I'm not a chef that thinks I know it all. I'm, again, a student. I'm always looking for inspiration, and my food is just paying tribute and homage to the women that don't have a voice in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
The moms, the grandmas.
Yeah.
That can make tears fall out of your face with the food they cook. You know, I listen to certain songs, and I eat certain dishes, and it literally feels like a knot is in my throat, because it reminds me of a woman, a grandma, my grandmother. Certain songs, I like, literally bring me to my knees, because it's eating is a sensory experience. It's a story, and when you eat it, my food, I hope you remember, it resonates with you regardless of where you come from.
Yeah.
That's my favorite thing, is being able to having someone that isn't Mexican say, oh my God, this reminded me of the food I ate when I was growing up.
Yeah.
That's it. That's that magic that as chefs we have the ability to create.
Now, you just used the word magic. There is something spiritual about what you just described.
Yeah.
There is this, it's a weird thing that the book Whose, that, well, I just brought up the book Whose Door because, you know, there used to be a debate that would go on, right? And the debate was, like, I used to say to Gavin, why don't they just have, like, Thomas Keller design what the person's going to cook in this competition and then have the competitor cook it? Mm-hmm. And he said, because it won't taste the same if it's not their own food. If they haven't developed it themselves, right?
Or one recipe can be made by 10 people. I can tell you how to make exactly what I make at the restaurant, but you won't make it taste like I do.
Yeah.
It's just, again...
Yeah.
The movie, like, Water for Chocolate.
Yeah.
I always say that. That's kind of what I do.
So how do you... You're talking about a very personal thing. You're talking about, I assume I'm going to make a leap and say when you cook, you're tasting a lot.
Yeah.
The last moments of seasoning are probably super important.
Yeah.
Till you get that, probably something that triggers for you a memory, even if it's not a specific one or a feeling or a
right.
time. How do you convey to your cooks what you're looking for? Because it seems to me when something is as personal as what you do, that's when it becomes the hardest to have other people execute to what you have in your head. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, my favorite thing is getting cooks that don't have any experience in Mexican food or don't have any experience at all. I love people that just want to learn and that are green and just have the passion for cooking. You know, I have a cook that's been with me since we opened. To this day, he has me check his line to make sure that the flavors are right. And that's beautiful. That's, you know...
He has you do it, you
yeah.
said.
And he says, Chef, am I right? And then, you know, I always say, yeah, it's delicious, beautiful.
Yeah.
And I just tell them all the time, taste, 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 taste in the beginning. Set a timer at 7 o'clock because things reduce. If it's a braise, taste it again. Because you cannot expect the first plate to come out like the last plate if it's a braise, because it reduces. And
yeah.
all of a sudden you have, and it's happened to us. And I said, you know, you're only as good as the last dish.
Yeah.
People are only going to remember that last thing they tasted. They don't give a shit if they came 10 other times and it was great.
Yeah.
That last memory is what matters.
Yeah.
So it's always being willing to be like, I don't know if this tastes right. Check.
Yeah.
You know, and I just instill that in them. And sometimes it works, and sometimes, you know, I have to kind of smack them and be like, you have to ask. Because I do. Sometimes, you know, if my palate's off, if I'm feeling sick, I have my sous chef. Like, oh, Jesus, I don't know. And that's just being willing to be fluid and being willing to accept criticism, which I think is...
Yeah. Well, I think that's such a great point, what you just said. And not just in kitchens, but when you said you have to ask. You know, I think as much as a chef, manager, boss, whatever, manages the people who are, you know, under them on the pecking order, mm-hmm. I think as an employee, or as a, you have to also sometimes manage your boss, right? Because the more, and the more accomplished you become as a cook, and the more leeway you have, and the more trust the chef has in you, mm-hmm. the more it's on you when there does come a moment where you're unsure to raise your hand, because you've if you've demonstrated a certain amount of self-sufficiency, right? I mean, I think the, what all chefs want is somebody to make their lives easier. I think that's what they want, and that's one of the things they want in cooks, right? I mean, whether or not they would phrase it that way, I think that's what it amounts to.
Right.
So if you show that aptitude, you're going to get a lot of rope, right?
Yeah, I mean, I use the same methodology as a mom. It's like, don't make me be your mom. Make me be, you know, we're allies until you have to, I have to be your mom.
Yeah.
And I tell my cook the same. It's like, I'm a cook, and I am right next to you. Don't make me be your boss.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable for all of us.
Right.
You know, but it's an alliance that we all have, you know, for the greater good of the restaurant.
Yeah.
It's not about me. It's about the food we put out.
So what you just mentioned about taking in people with no cooking experience, that requires an awful lot of time and commitment. Mm-hmm. You're happy to put that in?
I am. I don't know if it's women's intuition, but I do have a good knack of finding the people that really give a damn.
Yeah.
And the people that don't are the ones. I mean, I had when we opened, it was very anticipated, so we had a lot of people wanting to work there, but for the wrong reasons. And they themselves worked themselves out of a job. You know, I had a cook pull me aside and said, "Are we gonna make enchiladas forever?" And I looked at him and I said, "What did you eat growing up?" Enchiladas. Okay, and what was the only thing you could afford at that time? You know, it's like, so he missed the mark of what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
It wasn't about making enchiladas every day. I mean, it changes very often. It was really just paying tribute to what we know and what was comfort food for us.
Yeah.
And then showing it to people that San Diego's never seen. We have a lot of Mexican food, but not very good Mexican food.
Yeah.
So our goal was always show what we eat, what Mexicans eat at home.
Yes.
You know, and it's different.
Yeah. Okay, I would probably not have asked this question, but we were just on a panel together, and you made reference to yourself, and you said you look like a comic book.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and ask this question, because you told me you were interested in being a lawyer.
Yeah.
I do not associate the look that you have.
Well, that's why I'm not a lawyer.
with lawyers, but did you have? Did you always? Were you always sort? Did you always? You know, did you always kind of express yourself in the way, you know, with what you wear, with tattoos, with you currently have purple hair,
yeah,
lipstick to match, very cool glasses, like, but you're very put together in a very expressive way, right? Was that always the case, or was that something that came after you decided to go on a different track?
No, I mean, in seventh grade, I was buying my clothes. My mom thought I was the weirdest kid, and I was... You know, I was one of the weird kids. I was the loner because I wore green bell bottoms and, you know, I had a purple cast my seventh grade year. I had bangs that were curly. I was an awkward kid. I listened to music that not really, you know, my friends didn't listen to because I had grown up with, you know, a bunch of Mexican kids. The first time I listened to punk music, I was like, oh, shit, I'm home. You know,
I was just going to ask if it was punk that you listened to.
Yeah, I listened to punk music and, you know, Irish Celtic punk. I have this, my playlist is a little schizophrenic, but at the same time, I listened to Billy Joel. I listened to Elton John, and I listened to all these people that were very confident in who they were. And I think that the overlying theme is I've always just been me. And to some people, you know, one of my great friends in high school used to tell me, oh, that's unique. But that was her way of saying that she didn't like what I was wearing.
Mm.
And that still kind of like vibrates in my ears. And it's like, I've always been this way. I've always been kind of beating to my own drum and marching to my own drum. And Yeah, I have no problem being, you know, uncomfortable to watch for some people.
And as a kid, were you okay with that? Like, yeah. When you say you were a little bit of, you know, a loner.
Yeah, my dad hated that I wasn't, I was non-conforming.
Right, but you were fine with it.
Yeah.
It didn't bother you. You didn't care if that.
No, because my mom always kind of indulged that in me.
Yeah.
She would buy me the weird shit.
Yeah.
You know, she was right. Okay with me being the weird kid.
It's always the moms.
It's always
the moms. Will, right? Whatever you're doing, they're all, you, I mean, I'm overstating it. That's not always true. But it's more often true that if a kid is a certain way, whatever it is, and if one parent is it more accepting of it, it's always the mom.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, in sixth grade camp, I wasn't allowed to shave my legs, and I was in a house. Basically, with a bunch of, you know, American girls with blonde hair, blue eyes that all shaved their legs. And here this Mexican kid was, you know, with hair holding up her socks. That was, you know, so I knew I was just different from the onset. Yeah. And I was okay with it.
Yeah. When you look back, you know, you just, you know, the way you like to dress as a kid, like the discovering punk music. Do you think it was like, do you feel like it was inevitable that you, like when you said you listened to punk music and you knew you were home, did you feel the same way when you finally found your way to a kitchen?
Yeah. There was, I've, you know, as a single mom, you kind of have to do anything to keep food on your table.
Yeah.
I've worked as a bookkeeper for a nonprofit for 3 years while I was a line cook at night. I've worked check cashing place. I worked at IKEA, you know, at the returns department, anything to get food on my table while my craft was trying to be developed, you know, and I think that makes me a well-rounded person, not just cook, and I can really work with any type of personality because of this history.
Yeah.
But I think that it was inevitable because as soon as I set foot in a kitchen, I realized that it was a lot of broken children. We're a lot of broken.
Yeah.
We are people that come from all walks of life that really can only do this one thing good. And we share in our, you know, in our kind of sketchy childhoods, and you're just kind of like, misfits.
Yeah.
I love my misfits. I love listening to the misfits. I love listening to Black Flag. It's like all these things have a commonality with the kitchen, and the kitchen's, it doesn't matter where you come from, that's home.
It's funny because, you know, that word misfits, to me, it's almost like onomatopoetic, like, right? But it's so weird for someone who writes, because that word's actually in the subtitle of my book that I wrote about chefs. But I just last night, I heard that word somewhere. I forget where it was. And I thought, you know, when you break it down, because it does just sound like outcasts or whatever, right. But it's misfit. It's people who don't fit in.
We're the square pegs.
The square pegs.
Yeah.
It's really, and that's very much the feeling that a lot of cooks have conveyed to me of like not fitting in elsewhere, you know, not thinking they could be in an office, you know, not dressing, not just in the kind of fashion forward way that you do or artistic way that you do, but also just people who don't want to put on like a button down shirt and, you know, who want to live in a t-shirt basically, you know, and kitchens, that works. It all works for people. Mm-hmm. Can I just, as you were talking about working those two, you know, years working two jobs.
Yeah.
How much sweeter does that make where you are right now? Do you ever think about those days?
I do.
I would think that would be pretty sweet.
My kid remembers when we had to play hide and seek because our lights got shut off. You know, it's this weird thing that happens when you look back, and I guess because I was raised as a perfectionist, I was raised as you have to be perfect, you know, a very Mexican household, you know,
good grades.
I think now I don't really think that this is it.
Yeah.
So in my head, I'm going, well, no, because the light just keeps going further back. You know, it's.
Yeah.
Where I'm going isn't even near where I'm at right now.
Sure.
But at the same time, I do kind of sit back and say, wow, like, I once prayed for all these things, and I once hoped that I could give my children everything they wanted, and we're not exactly there, but I don't have to say no as much.
Yeah.
Which is a really sweet part.
Well, it's like your menu, right? You said it's the past, present, and future.
Yeah.
That's your past, present, and future.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The past was tough.
Yeah.
Present's pretty good, and you want the future to be even better.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for taking a few minutes.
Yeah, thanks for wanting to talk.
Really good to meet you.
Likewise.
All right, Caitlin, my last interview is with Francisco Magoya. I said this earlier in the show. I think we had a bromance.
I'm really happy for you.
I do. This is the guy. If he was in New York, we would have. You know, like my buddy Evan Song. You know how Evan and I got to be pals? And here's why I say it. Here's why I've said it repeatedly. I think the older you get, the less common it is
to make new friends.
To make new friends.
I totally agree.
It just is.
Also, you don't have a lot of time, so that's part of it.
Yeah, and I sometimes think about, you know, Confucius had a line, like, you will know your friends better in the first, 3 minutes than you will an acquaintance in a lifetime or something like that. I believe Francisco and I will have time together in the future.
Mm. Okay.
I do. I think we had a real connection. We liked each other. I think we had an instant respect for each other. And I hope he's someone I'll get to spend some time with getting to know.
I really love it when that happens, because it does not happen very often.
But you know what I mean. Do you think it's weird I'm saying it on the air? Do you think Francisco's listening to this going, eey.
Maybe I don't want to be his
friend. I better block that guy's number.
No, I think it's rare. I think it's
rare. But you know what I mean? It's rare to connect like that
it's
with
rare
someone.
Rare to connect. And also, you know, frankly, the fact that you're saying it and you're a dude, like, that's pretty great.
What? Okay.
Well, I just don't think that, like, guys will say, like, it's harder to make friends when you get older. It's true. I just think it's
right. So true, and I've felt this way since I was in my 30s. I remember saying to someone I got to be really good friends with in my 30s, you know, having dinner and saying, like, hey, dude, I just want to tell you, like, this is rare.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Anyway, that's my feeling. I'm not embarrassed to say it publicly.
I don't think you should be.
No.
Okay.
I'm not. I think it's just very open. This is how we are in 2019.
Right. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Keeps you young.
Well, okay.
All right, Caitlin. With that, I think this is a great conversation. It's a little more food-focused than a lot of these. You know, I tend to be much more about biography, but because Francisco is so associated with the modernist movement, we did kind of go deep on that, and I think even if that's not something that floats your boat, I think you will enjoy this conversation. It will make you understand what it's all about, and maybe even make those of you who are non-believers a little more interested in seeing how it might apply to your life in the kitchen. I'll put that out there. Okay, here you go. My conversation with Francisco Magoya. I hope you enjoy it. I'm always curious, especially somebody who has a area of specialization the way that you do. How many days a year, roughly, do you find yourself speaking in front of a, you know, an audience, in the way that you just were? You seem very polished up there. You seem to have it down. How often do you do that?
Well, let me tell you where that comes from. I used to teach, and so I used to teach, you know, teenagers in culinary school, and there's no way you're going to get their attention unless you're engaging, unless you're saying things that are going to be interesting and useful. And it doesn't mean you have to be a clown, but it means that you have to know your audience, you know. And so I think that it, for me, that was formative in public speaking. I probably do these maybe once a month, once every 2 months.
Oh, that's all.
Yeah, well, but I also teach, like, every now and then I'll teach classes abroad.
Yes.
Yeah, I have one coming up in Indonesia in a couple of weeks.
Wow.
And so you have to be able to speak to people in a way that they're going to want to listen to you.
Do you find yourself adapting to different audiences?
Yeah. You know, I mean, people who speak, they'll tell you that they have jokes that they use that work all the time.
Right.
And if you make that joke and it didn't work for a particular crowd, it's going to be a hard crowd.
Yeah.
Not because they don't have a sense of humor, but there's something in the air that is just not right.
Yes.
And it can ruin your presentation because you already have that in your head. It can't get away and out of your head that whatever you said that you thought was going to be a huge hit, it just fell flat on the floor.
Yeah.
It's not that different from doing comedy stand-up.
Yeah, well, I'm a comedy fanatic.
Okay.
And the way you were just talking is exactly the way, if you hear a comic interviewed, it's very similar.
Right. Except
you're not there to get laughs.
No, and if I get a few, I consider myself fortunate. I'm there to, you know, for people when I'm done, I want them to have a takeaway. You know, even if they remember one thing.
Yeah.
Or two, I'm grateful for that. Because holding people's attention for that long is asking a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. this was only 35 minutes, mm-hmm. but I've done talks that are an hour 10, an hour 15,
mm-hmm.
and it's just keeping people like engaged. You see a few people in the audience who are starting to nod off. That's your cue that you need to mix it up. Or
well, although here
or,
they're sitting out in the sun, so.
And that was that too, and after lunch, which, right?
Right. So, and maybe after some beers, you know,
some beers.
Yeah.
It's like holy.
So I wouldn't take the nap personally here.
Right. No, but but you think you see it. You will always see it.
Yes.
Like, but you know, in comedy clubs, you don't see the audience. I think that's maybe a good thing because it's in the mm-hmm. dark. But here, you can see everybody's face looking at you. You know, it's a different thing.
Have you studied have you studied stand-up comics or other types of non-culinary presenters to hone that part of what you do?
I don't know that I've necessarily studied, but I've paid attention to it.
Sure. That's better said. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I pay attention to see like what TED Talks are. Like, if I'm going to go to the TED Talk podcasts, which are the best? Because there's so many. Where do I start? I'm going to start by the ones that are the best, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then those lead you to others and so forth. But why are they the best?
Yes.
And that has to do with really how people have reacted to them,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that sort of kind of stays with you. Like, what is it? How were they saying their presentation?
Yeah.
When people stutter or they have too many crutches.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, that's okay to do that. But there's a point where it's too much. You're going to lose people,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I learned a lot of that from, I guess, by osmosis. Not necessarily like taking notes, but it's like, why are these
being observant?
Why do these talks work?
And being
and why did I like it so much?
Yeah.
And so being more mindful about when mm-hmm. I'm hearing somebody talk, what is it that and how did they do it that I enjoyed it
so
much?
So can we just briefly talk about this term that's emblazoned on your shirt?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Modernist.
Yes.
For me, and maybe I'm wrong, I feel like there was a point in time, and I felt like we all thought we'd be using the term forever,
mm-hmm.
where molecular was around. What?
Were you going to say molecular gastronomy?
Molecular is an adjective.
Yeah,
and
but
then
all gastronomy is molecular.
Yes, no, I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. I'm not. But then I feel like, and I think it largely had to do with this, with modernist, you know, with the books and the, mm-hmm. you know, or with modern. I feel like modernist became a more apt term
mm-hmm.
for what people were trying to describe
mm-hmm.
with that term molecular.
Yes, I agree.
Right, because it was more broad, mm-hmm. and also because, and this is what I'd love to get your opinion on. To me, the big failing of the whole molecular thing for mm-hmm. me. Is I think there was this moment where there was this big mistake being made by some chefs,
yes,
and by the public that that the means was the end,
yeah.
That some kind of an effect
mm-hmm.
that not necessarily flavor or texture
mm-hmm.
achieved with through scientific means, through additives and whatnot, was a style of food in and of itself. And I think
100% agree.
And I think people learned that was actually, that was kind of a fool's errand, right? I just would love your response to that comment, because you know infinitely more about this than I do.
No, and
probably have thought about it way more than I have.
I've thought about it a lot, because when this whole, like, you know, using additives and so forth came to become so popular, in the wrong hands, it could be disastrous. It mm-hmm. could be disgusting food. And so the information on how to do these things, how much of this additive to it, and that, it was readily available, and people exchanged information, and books were published way before ours with all of that information on how to make all these gels, these foams, emulsions, etc. And so people started toying with it, and because a few people became known for it that were really good at it, like the Adria brothers,
mm-hmm.
The Roca brothers, although they don't do that so much anymore, Andoni Aduris from Mugaritz, they really started to push those boundaries, but they did it in a very cerebral, intelligent way. I would say that in their hands, it could be a delicious experience.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're not mindful about what you're doing, you're just doing it for the whiz-bang and the smoke and mirrors,
yeah.
I mean, that is going to give anything a bad reputation.
Yeah.
You know? And so I that's why I take pause with that term, because it does have negative associations. I mean, it does, you know, a funny part, I'm going to like sidetrack on this,
yeah.
but it's funny to me how molecular gastronomy is, you ask any of these young guys out here what they think of it, they'd be like, oh, that's old school.
Already, yeah.
Yeah, that's
right.
It's already, and that's when I realized that I'm getting old. Because to me, it's not like it was new, and I don't think of it as a new thing anymore. But to now have somebody already think about it as like, this is old school.
But I think that speaks to how kind of, you know, what a detour it was. Because I feel like it got old the way... There was an old movie called The Hunger. Did you ever see The Hunger? It was a vampire movie.
Oh, yeah.
At the beginning of the movie, David Bowie goes from being like a guy in his 20s or 30s and instantly ages into death, like over the course of about an hour.
Uh-huh.
Something went wrong. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's molecular orchestra, right?
For
I feel like it didn't have the lifespan that... We're still using the term New American Cuisine. Goes back to the 80s.
Yes.
Right? Nouvelle Cuisine was a term, for better or for worse...
Mm-hmm.
You know, lasted for, 10, 15 years at least.
And it started many other styles.
Yes, and that was actually, and it actually existed before it had a name.
Right.
Right? So, but molecular, I feel like people quickly learned I think, you know, a lot of some of those additives and whatnot I've learned are used in places that people actually don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know people now who use xanthan gum to make sure their Bear Blancs don't break.
It's a great application. In fact,
Never know that because you don't think of that restaurant even as the restaurant I'm thinking of, which they probably wouldn't want me to say that.
Mm-hmm.
You think of it as a place that runs in a very traditional French mode.
Yes.
But they're using... something that most people would think of as, you know, the bailiwick of somebody like a Ferran Adrià
Yeah. Well, but that's the thing. It's like now it's become ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And it's not something that has a name anymore. Like now we use sous vide.
Yeah.
You know, now we use, if we want to make sure that our sauce, you know, the water doesn't leach or separate out of it, add 0.1% xanthan gum and you're good.
Right.
And you're not like, you're not doing anything that seems extraordinary anymore.
Yes.
You're just utilizing something that you know how to use. It's in your pantry. You can get xanthan gum on Amazon. It's an easy thing. It's an easy get, and it's an easy fix to many things.
So how would you define modernist cuisine?
I think as the same way I would describe modernist art, it's a reaction to something that used to be...
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't question it. We would just do it because that's how we were told to do it. You made art this way because this is how you were supposed to make art. And the modernists, their mentality was like, we're going to really step... very far away from this, and we're going to question it. And, you know, I have to say that when you take a deep look and a deep dive into certain things, and in this case food, you're going to find a lot of stuff that was done because people do it because that's just the way it's been done.
Yeah.
And nobody, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, that it was one of those things where, like, if I make stock this way, it always turns out that way. And why am I going to even fix this? Why would I even think about grinding all of my ingredients first before making the stock to get more flavor out of the components of my stock? Like, so these were things that Nathan, my boss, had to think about.
Sure.
And they just applied to so many things. And in bread in particular, there were so many of those almost folkloric myths that people associate with bread. Because bread has been hand in hand with mankind since mankind has been mankind, at least in most Western countries, right? Because obviously you can't talk about China and bread simultaneously. I mean, Bao being the exception, but Bao's you need a very soft flour for that.
Sure.
And a lot of things have to happen to get that pure white, super soft flour. So it's a more modernish sort of bread.
Was there, you know, I think, a couple of things about what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's just people doing, you know, wanting to hold on to things because it's the way it's always been done.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's this feeling that, I think there's a very sort of almost masochistic strain that runs through professional cooks.
Yeah.
And there's this feeling that, like, well, let's take the Bear Blanc example, that's cheating, right? Oh, you can't make that, you can't do that naturally the way I did it in cooking school?
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you're not as good as a cook as I am. You know, my reaction would be, well, I think cooks and chefs sometimes can almost forget that there's a diner out there that doesn't really care how you got from A to Z. They just want the dish to taste right.
No, and I will always argue against being willfully ignorant or not using as many resources as you can to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
It's the reason why we have spaceships and satellites and we're not cooking over an open fire.
Sure.
To, you know, we're not cavemen anymore.
Yes.
It's because of people who thought a little bit differently and
yes.
wanted to improve and make. It doesn't have to be hard to be good.
Well, you don't even have to go to a spaceship. You could just go to a bike.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, things with wheels.
And we're also not going out and hunting for our own dinner anymore.
No.
Yeah.
No. And now we do it because we want to, right?
Yes.
I mean, you go and if you're a hunter-chef, it's because you want to be a hunter-chef.
Yes.
It's not like, this is the only way I can provide a protein in my restaurant is by going hunting.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So we have options now. And to close yourself off to those things.
Yes.
To me is 100% absurd. I'll say it again. It doesn't have to be hard to do to
mm-hmm.
be good.
So what are some of the things, you know, when we talk about modernist cuisine, what are some of the more, for lack of a better word, everyday
mm-hmm.
applications
mm-hmm.
of some of the techniques,
mm-hmm.
Additive, you know, whatever words you would use. What are some things that maybe
uh-huh.
have the most sort of universal application that people maybe aren't aware of?
Now, I have a few easy, good ones that I like to talk to people about because of that, because it's something that they can use in their everyday lives. I mean, if you make bread in your everyday life, which is not a very common thing. I mean, there's a bunch of people who do it, but it's not super common. But I like to throw people these like few tips and tricks to make their life easier with
yes.
bread. So, for example, if we talk about bagels or pretzels or challah bread, so these are very low hydration, meaning they don't have a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are very stiff doughs. If you
mm-hmm.
think about a bagel, the crumb is very tight. Pretzel is also very tight. So what this means to the baker is that this dough is very hard to handle. And if you try to roll it out, it's going to snap back like a rubber band because that gluten is just like super strong and
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have a lot of leeway because it's so tight.
Mm-hmm.
So you roll it out and it rolls back up. And then you roll it out again and then you got it to be a little bit longer, but then it's going to start pulling back in again.
Right.
So,
like a tendon.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So what industrial bread production has done is, you know, they basically purified a bunch of dough relaxers that come from many different sources, and they have very long names that people are afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
But industry uses it for those breads. So we took a lot of inspiration from those sorts of applications, and how do we make this friendly for people to use at home? And it turns out that there are many dough relaxers in your refrigerator right now, for example, that
mm-hmm.
are what we. I'm going to use air quotes. I know this is a podcast, and it's absurd to do air quotes.
That's okay.
On a podcast,
well, not
but
if you say it.
Now people
yeah.
imagine it, and they understand when I say natural ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that kiwi juice, pineapple juice, papaya juice, they have an enzyme that will relax dough naturally. And if you literally add 3 drops of this dough to 1 kilo of bagel dough or pretzel dough, it'll relax it to make it super easy to work.
3 drops of the juice.
3 drops. 3 literal drops.
So the flavor effect is negligible.
0.
Yeah.
And you can get a fruit cup at Starbucks, save the pineapple so you don't have to buy a huge pineapple. And those 3 or 4 drops that you're going to add to the dough are going to make your life so much easier. Because you're going to be able to roll the dough out, it'll cooperate, and it doesn't affect the final texture.
When you bake
all.
It,
no.
does what it's always done.
Yes. But it's that initial handling that's going to make your life easier.
Yeah.
Other practical applications, you know, we took this giant leap one day, and we decided to overproof bread, right? Those are one of the biggest problems that bakers at home have, which is like they forget about the dough. It over.
Oh, you mean that it's resting?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, resting is a little bit different. Fermenting is when it's already in a basket or in a baking pan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you're
right?
saying. Okay.
So the yeast is doing all this fermentation work,
okay.
right? Is what gives us the rise, gives us the aroma, flavor, etc. But, you know, sometimes you walk away or it's too hot in your kitchen or you forgot about it and you come back and it's like...
And you have a horror, horror film on your hands, right?
You do because... Yeah. Bread is not expensive in and of itself, the ingredients. What's expensive is your time.
Yeah.
Right? And the time you invest in this bread. Especially if you're making it at home, it was maybe for a special occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you wanted to, you know, give it a shot. You bought this book and you wanted to make some bread at home.
Mm-hmm.
And so you did everything, but then you forgot to set a timer. And
yeah.
you come back to this sad, collapsed balloon. So we did that on purpose because we had this gut feeling that we could actually rescue that collapsed piece of dough.
Can I interrupt you for one second?
Because
I just want to be in the moment here.
Uh-huh.
When you say you had this gut feeling,
uh-huh.
what was it? Like, was it based on previous experimenting you had done? Was it just a just an instinctual thing that you can't put words to?
Well, no, the gut feeling is it is backed by something that we observe, which is it's something that happens with pizza dough all the time, right? You take any pizzeria will take a ball of dough, press the life out of it,
yes,
to make it flat,
yeah,
and then it goes in the oven and it just balloons up again,
mm,
like a magic act. There's doughs like focaccia dough that you do this thing that's called stippling, which is basically like you're pressing down with your fingers,
yeah,
and to any person that, you know, maybe is not very familiar with bread, it might seem like the opposite of what you want to do to it. Don't you want to keep it, you know, intact and,
mm-hmm,
you know, why are you pressing down on it?
Yeah.
And then you put it in the oven and you get these beautiful bubbles on the inside. So the reason why those things work for those breads is because what you're doing is you are popping some of the bubbles in the dough,
mm-hmm,
but you're also making them stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Think of a balloon.
Sure.
A balloon will expand as much as it possibly can before it pops, right?
Yep.
Why does it pop? Because the walls of the balloon become too thin, and it just can't hold that air anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact same thing in a fermented piece of dough.
Yeah.
Those bubbles fill up with CO2, they fill up with ethanol, but there's a point where they're just going to be, they can't hold all of that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's when your dough starts to deflate and collapse, and then it's just the saddest, you know, thing you can see.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like, okay, let's take this. It was basically a French lean dough. We over fermented it on purpose by a lot, like maybe like we went over an hour after it had over fermented. So to the naked eye, it would have seemed like, you know, this is going to go in the trash. Why even bother?
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted to make sure that it was really, really over fermented. We took that piece of dough, we reshaped it, meaning we put it back into the shape that you give it to put it into a flour,
mm-hmm,
you know, basket to ferment. And we waited. And by doing that, by basically reshaping it, what we did is we created new nucleation points, new little bubbles. And the bubbles that had collapsed, basically what we did by reshaping it is those bubbles, we gave them new life by making their walls stronger. Right,
mm-hmm.
So now we don't have this giant bubble. Now we have tiny bubbles. So these tiny bubbles are now, they have the ability to take air in again and expand again. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But what we weren't sure about is like, is yeast still going to do anything here? Is yeast and the lactic acid bacteria, they're still going to do their thing or not? And in reality, it wasn't a great expense to us to sacrifice 1 kilo of dough to find out whether it was going to work or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we put it into our fermentation box, it was 80 degrees Fahrenheit. An hour and a half later, it was ready to bake again. And it had a beautiful color, it was beautifully expanded. And we baked it, and it looked like a normal piece of bread.
Mm-hmm.
The crust was a really nice, like, you know, dark brown. The crumb had a nice alveolation. It was like a normal piece of bread. You didn't have that smell of, you know, typically over fermented dough smell like alcohol. This did not. So then we thought, okay, did we get lucky or should we just try this again? So we tried again a bunch of times with a bunch of different breads, and it worked with a bunch of different breads. And then we thought, well, let's see if we can do it twice. Let's see if we can over ferment the dough twice.
Over ferment it, bring it back, over ferment it again.
Yes.
Okay.
And we got greedy. We got up to 10.
You did 10, let it happen 10 times?
10 times. And that is really just to prove a point. Because nobody, I mean,
right,
sure, somebody might be able to do that. Somebody
yeah.
might
the character, the lead character in Memento.
Right. Yeah, exactly. or somebody who really shouldn't be making bread.
Right.
Or shouldn't be.
Or using an oven.
Right.
Using an oven, right.
And I will say that I think we stopped at 10, I seem to remember, because it just started to get really tight. Like the bread
yeah.
just was like, it was super strong. Every time you handle dough and you shape it and pull
yeah, yeah.
and tug, you make it stronger and stronger and stronger, which is good, but there's a point where it's too strong. And so this bread was just like, it was this like tense ball of dough, but it baked beautifully. It got us a beautiful color on the outside, and it was still a bread that you could eat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the big pushes that we want to do in our book, which is, you know, bread is an easy thing to waste. People take it for granted. It's cheap. At least grocery store bread is cheap. even artisan bread is cheap. I mean, $4 or $5 for a loaf of bread is not that much to pay.
No. Yeah, so people lose. Well, you talk about losing track of it, you know, proofing the dough, but people really lose track of, you know, the lifespan of the bread.
Yes.
You know, just and yeah, it's you like, know, all of a sudden it's there's a little mold and
or stale.
It's too late. Yeah.
And there's ways to reverse staling too, like you can reverse that in your bread just by. That's another method we developed, which is if your bread is starting to feel stale to you, you can wrap it in foil. You throw it in your oven, and once it reaches a core temperature of 185 degrees Fahrenheit, you've essentially... I don't want to bore you with all the details of how it happens.
No, it's not boring me at all.
But what you did is you reverse staling. Staling is basically water leaching out of the starch, so the starch is not gelatinous anymore. It's not stretchy. It's crystalline again. So that's why the bread doesn't feel stretchy anymore. It feels crumbly.
Yeah.
It's because the starch is losing all this water. It's separating out of the starch. When you get it hot again to 185 degrees Fahrenheit, you have reversed that effect. Basically, the water gets reabsorbed into the starch. And so the starch is, again, nice and stretchy. And it's like you have a brand new loaf of bread. And you don't have to throw it away.
Right. Okay. So... there may or may not be an answer to this. If not, I'll just edit out the question. But I'm just curious. You mentioned a minute ago this idea of having, you know, having a gut feeling about something. You are looking at things that people, a lot of people haven't looked at all or thought about at all. You're like you said, you're taught to do it. I also feel like, it was funny, Magnus Nilsson was on this show in the fall. He had his Nordic baking book come out. And he talked about the difference that for people... between eating bread, especially freshly baked bread, and almost any other kind of food. You know, that there was something very soul-satisfying about that, right? So I think people, like you said, it's very much based on tradition. You were taught either by a relative, or you were taught by a baker in a job, and that's how you do it, right? You've examined so many of these things. And you, when we started this interview, alluded to how long people have been eating bread, right? Have you ever had a moment where you feel like you have a thought about how people first happened onto baking in general, about how this came into existence?
Yes, and
like almost anthropologically, just based on your own trial and error and experience.
There's a lot of the common history of bread that you're going to read in most books is that the Egyptians invented bread 5,000 years ago. This is a story you hear over and over and over and over again.
But that's, I'm assuming, strictly based on where there's some kind of indication that bread existed.
Yes.
But without the story of how we got there.
They depicted a lot.
Right, exactly. But without an explanation of how that happened.
Right. Because you have to think that, you know, grain has been around for a long period of time, and so has mankind. There was a very interesting find in Mozambique in a cave where they found this it was a rock that was used for grinding. They found traces of ground up sorghum from 105,000 years ago. So what do you do with ground up sorghum? You're going to mix it with water and you're going to make something with that.
Yeah.
Whether that was like a flatbread, or whether it was, you know, maybe people were already making beer, then there's this big question, what was first, beer or bread?
Sure.
You know, it's not that different in the process one from the other. But if you have found traces of pulverized sorghum, you have to wonder, well, maybe bread is not 5,000 years old. Maybe bread is at least 105,000 years old. And it's you see all these grains that are edible, they're huge, but what do you do? Well, let's take a rock and, you know, make them smaller so that we can, you know, mix them with water and we can eat it, because you can't eat a grain as it is, you know? So that's already mankind thinking about how to utilize this thing that they found in nature. But there isn't a trace that you can't say bread was invented at this, you know, moment in time exactly.
No, but I don't mean that, but I meant how, like you just talked about mixing flour and water, and then you'd have to get to the place where it does whatever version of baking there was.
Right. Well, but the thing is also with that is that nobody really knew about fermentation until Louis Pasteur came along.
Right.
Everything before that was done intuitively. Yeah. Okay, you mix water and flour, you're going to get a bubbly thing in a few days, and so then use that bubbly thing, or, you know, go to the brewer and take barm, which is that you know, that foam that is on top of the brewing beer, and bakers would mix that into water and flour. They didn't know why it worked, but it's just like, it's one of these things, like, well, it works, and it was almost like sorcery at that point,
right?
Until Louis Pasteur explained it away. You know, so discovering microbiology gave everybody the answers that they were looking for when it came to bread fermentation. And eventually we were able to isolate Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is the yeast strand that we use for bread.
Yeah.
And that's what gave us commercial yeast. You know, yep. you can now get it at your grocery store.
Sure. Right? So, okay. The flip side of the same question.
Mm-hmm.
If we're here in the modernist moment, right?
Yes.
And I think there is this tendency. One of my favorite one-liners of all time was the comedian Gilbert Gottfried said, you know, that he wondered if people in ancient Rome walked around saying, boy, this is a long time ago, right? Because that's what our point of view is, sort of like, you know, you kind of feel like we're living in, this is it, right? But obviously things will continue to evolve and change. So if we're in the modernist moment right now, do you have any sense of, do you have like a sense of what a postmodernist movement might look like, or are there things, effects, results, things that you kind of dream of, but haven't figured out how to do yet, that maybe you think will be the next part of the next generation?
So, I think there was a, after this whole molecular gastronomy moment, there was almost a response to it to go in the opposite direction, completely, cooking with fire and, you know, like going back to, you know, these ancient forms of cooking, which can produce delicious food if you know how to do it and how to harness fire. I mean, that's, you know, the Asador Echevarri, that all they do is cook with fire, and it's so beautiful to look. It's like, that's an amazing place, but not everybody can do that.
Yes.
You know? There's, you know, fire is all good and well, but it's very tricky. It's very hard to cook properly with that. I don't want to go into this tangent of cooking with fire, but my point is that I think that we're, you know, I don't know where the future of food is going, but I haven't gotten excited about many things in a while. The molecular gastronomy thing was exciting.
Yeah.
Right? It was just like, holy cow. I mean, like, I'm sure back in the day, Nouvelle Cuisine was to a lot of chefs.
Yeah.
It's a new thing. We can do things differently. I think that there's still a lot of lessons that we took from molecular gastronomy, or that style, that helped us think that there's more than a few ways to skin a cat, and that there's no one right way to do things, you know? And that's what I think modernism is. Are we living in a postmodern gastronomic era? I don't know, because when did modernism...
When did something begin? When does it end? You don't really know until later. Yeah.
But I would definitely say that, you know, if we had to, you know, like, come out with a second edition of Modernist Cuisine, I think we would take a very close look at some of those things and see, like, well, do people still have use for some of these things in here? Or do we shorten this and expand on that? You know, where is gastronomy now versus where it was when the book came out? I mean, the book came out in 2011.
It
was like right at the
amazing
cusp.
It's been that long already.
It is. I mean, we're looking at 8 years now that the book came out. And it took 5 years to write. So you got to also, like, tie that in, because they had already been thinking in those terms.
Well, right? To your point, there was a book just maybe 2-3 years ago called What If We're Wrong? Do you know that? By Chuck Klosterman.
I'm familiar with him, but I'm not familiar with that book.
And it's the subtitle was something like Looking at the Present Through the Lens of the Future, right?
Mm-hmm, okay.
And the point was that very often, well, first of all, when historians come along, I went through this experience writing my book, right? There's you can't include everybody.
Oh, no.
So the past becomes whittled down, right? So reggae music will be, you know, Bob Marley, Jimmy Cliff, one or two other people, and that'll be reggae music, you know? William Shakespeare was not the only person writing plays during his lifetime, right? But who else could most people name,
right?
And when you just said, maybe if you would go back at some point already, just 8 years later, and reevaluate modernist cuisine, you might emphasize certain things and de-emphasize other things.
Sure.
And there really is no way to know any of that until you're in the future.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's things that, you know, if we explain how ovens work, they'll always work the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, that the information that exists on things like that, how steaming works, how frying foods work, like those things, they still have that application. But there's, you know, if you have a recipe for, you know, spherified olives, I mean, no, they're delicious. I mean, every time I go to Barcelona, I go to Tickets and I have those olives because they're just fantastic. But nobody's doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. It's not a thing that anybody has any interest in doing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So why, like, how much real estate are you going to give something like that?
Yes.
In a book that, you know, 10, 15 years after it published, does that really matter? What matters now?
Yeah.
So that's a huge question, and I don't have the answer to that.
Yeah. Right, interesting. Can you, drastically different note, this will be in the past, speaking of the future.
Mm-hmm.
But you're doing a dinner tomorrow night.
Yes.
Here in San Diego.
Yes.
With Claudette, who is also on this on this episode of the show.
Uh-huh.
Can you just tell me a little bit about that collaboration and how you two have approached that? And again, this will have already happened, so I'm not plugging it.
Uh-huh.
But I'm just curious to know, you know, somebody with your orientation,
uh-huh,
somebody who comes to things the way you do,
uh-huh,
how did you two go about figuring out what you were going to do and what's that going to look like?
So the theme of these dinners is, you know, like, food memorias is what she calls it. So it's Spanglish. I was born in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
She's born in Mexico too. I was born in Mexico. My dad is from Spain, and my mom was from Queens, New York.
Okay. You have some Italian in your ancestry, no?
Yeah, my mom she's Italian American.
Yeah.
So I was born in Mexico, so that was it was a big part of my culture. But I also had a lot of European like influence in you know, growing up. But I have obviously a huge place in my heart for Mexico.
Sure.
Especially in current day. And it's not, I don't want to get into all of that political stuff, but in present day I have developed more of a sensitivity to that Mexicanness and what it means to be Mexican.
Of course.
What it means to be Mexican in an American country and so forth. And so she has her restaurant here. It's a Mexican restaurant, but it's not like a taqueria. She always has a hard time explaining it to people, and I get why, because people want to go there and have tacos. And she's like, we don't do tacos. And they're like, well, what do you mean we don't do tacos? So she has her work cut out for
her. So isn't that amazing in 2019 in a fairly cosmopolitan area? It's,
well, there's
kind of
that,
amazing.
And there's also the assumption that Mexican cooking should be cheap.
Well, right? That's a whole...
And so then she has the people who ask for tacos and then are like, why is this restaurant so expensive? So,
mm-hmm.
But she's trying to do something that I want to support, which is to have like give people this vision of Mexican cuisine that can be very elevated,
mm-hmm,
without being, you know, overly pretentious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many layers of flavor in Mexican cuisine. I don't have to explain it to you. I mean, this is it's one of my favorite foods, of course, because I was born there.
Yeah.
But there's just so much variety there. So we knew each other, interestingly, from social media. And, you know, and then we started following each other. And then, you know, we started, you know, messaging each other. And a couple of years ago, she asked me, hey, we should do a dinner at some point. And so it's one of those conversations that's like, yeah, okay, we'll talk about it. You know, it's always in the future. You never... It may or may not happen.
You mean it when you say it,
right?
But then you have to figure out when the hell to do it.
Actually doing it is a whole nother story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so the reason why I agreed to do it and like be firm about doing it was because I wanted this dinner to benefit. It's an association called Raices Texas.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So
basically,
great.
It's. They provide attorneys for children who are in cages in,
mm-hmm,
Texas right now,
mm-hmm,
which is I can't describe in words how horrendous that is.
Well, but the only time I think I've ever gone on a political rant on this, mm-hmm, show, and I heard those of you who think I should keep that out of the show,
mm-hmm,
but just to mention it since we're having this conversation,
uh-huh,
was that week.
Right.
I opened the show and I was like, I can't not use this,
but
whatever this
happening.
Platform is.
And it's still happening.
Yes.
It hasn't gone away.
No.
And so all of the proceeds from this dinner are going to go to benefit Raices Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't just want to go and have a dinner to, you know, I mean, of course I want people to be happy and enjoy their meal.
Yeah.
But I don't have anything to gain from it.
Yes.
But collaborating with a chef I respect... and making sure that, you know, there was a cause behind it. And so that's the main reason. And also it coincided that they invited me to do this talk here at Chef's Roll. so the stars aligned for mm-hmm. it, you know, and so that it made, like, saying no at this point would have been absurd, you know. It's mm-hmm. like it's like the universe saying, you know, putting everything in place so that you guys can do this, so you might yes. you should just do it.
Yeah. And so, what are you serving there?
So we're doing 6 courses. I'm doing a bread course, which is a sourdough that I made with, it's called huitlacoche, which is,
sure.
unfortunately, it's called corn smut in English.
Corn smut or corn fungus, corn, I think people
well,
say.
Which one is worse?
Yes, but that's the same thing, right?
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the fungus that grows on corn yep. during the rainy season, which yep. is delicious. So I made a sourdough with that, and so there's it's the course is sourdough with a mole butter, toasted seeds mm-hmm. on top. And she's doing 3 savory courses, which... I have to be honest, I don't remember on the top of my
That's
head
fine.
What they are right
mm-hmm.
now. But I'm doing 2 dessert courses. I'm doing a prickly pear sorbet.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a sorbet sandwich. It's in a cookie made with hoja santa, which uh-huh. in English is called root beer.
Sassafras.
Yes, yeah. I think so.
Yeah, it's that flavor.
Right.
Yeah.
So I made it so that it looked like a cactus.
Mm-hmm.
And then the dessert is going to be, it's a dessert that is executed with French technique, but with Mexican flavors.
Oh, cool!
So it's different layers, different components. There's like a Mexican cinnamon chantilly in there. There's a Mexican chocolate. It's a thing that's called a cremeux, which is like a creamy custard base. And it's basically various components. It's very cool because we're serving it. It's in the shape of a flower, and so it's. I named it after one of my grandfather's favorite songs, which is called La Feria de las Flores.
Okay.
And he was a Spaniard, but he came to Mexico and he
yep.
completely embraced the country. And one of his favorite songs was that song, and so it's named after my grandfather, after my grandfather's favorite song. And then I'm going to do a few mignardies based on, like, really not very good Mexican candies, but done in a way, if they were properly done, what they would look like.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing a couple of those, and you know, it's a, you know, we're seating 50 people.
Mm-hmm.
It should be a nice event. I mean,
sounds
I'm really
great.
Looking forward to it,
sounds
so.
Great. So last question for you. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a great conversation with Claudette today, and she mm-hmm. was talking about, you know, the restaurant as she thinks about it as a way of expressing her past, present, and future,
mm-hmm.
right? And she wants her food to be very emotional.
Mm-hmm.
You have a very strong connection to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
The dinner's called Food Memorias?
Food Memorias.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's an emotional notion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of people might hear a term like modernist cuisine
mm-hmm.
and think that that's antithetical
yes.
to creating food that has a soul.
Soulful.
Yep.
Soulful.
We just said the same word at the mm-hmm. same time,
yeah.
right? But there is, even to memory, there is science, right?
Mm-hmm.
People say that the olfactory sense
yes.
accounts, I don't know if they still say this, when I was in grade school, they used to say accounts for 90% of
sure.
taste,
well,
and is also the most powerful trigger
eventually.
For memory,
yes.
right? So I'm wondering, is it actually the opposite of what people think? Do you feel like you have knowledge
mm-hmm.
and capabilities where, again, it's a weird thing to talk about in such a calculated way,
mm-hmm.
but where you can actually maybe create a deeper
mm-hmm.
connection to the food through this sort of information?
Well,
or is it a push
no,
and it doesn't matter?
No, aroma, the so
does that question make sense?
It does, and I hope my answer makes sense.
Okay,
if I understand,
I'll try to
the
keep up.
Correctly.
Yeah.
So, the dessert I explained earlier, it's it looks like you're eating a flower.
Yeah.
But what I did is I'm serving it inside this clear acrylic box that's going to be filled with Mexican flowers.
Mm.
And what I'm doing is I'm making a very aromatic infusion of flowers that we're going to pour into these other into this acrylic box. So when it comes to your table, you have all this aroma
mm.
that is surrounding you. But it's not like it smells like cheap perfume. It's like it's a beautiful, very nuanced scent of flowers
yeah.
That are part of the component of the dessert.
Mm-hmm.
It's an element that I'm adding that is not something that you can actually taste, but it's an aroma that's going to influence how you're going to taste the dessert.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't did that answer
yeah, well,
question?
You said specifically Mexican flowers.
Yes.
So I assume the scent
for sure.
or the aroma has a meaning to you personally.
It does. And it might to somebody else in there, or it might have a different version.
Right, but I'm saying it's not like it's not strictly there as it is there for flavor or for the aroma, but not strict. In other words, it's no like for years now, people have been, you know, dishes come from the kitchen to a table sometimes with a thyme sprig, that's been lit, right? And it's but that's just that's. Mm-hmm. There's not a memory anyone's trying to evoke with that, usually, right? But in this case, it's a double effect in your, for you. It's that answer makes total sense to me.
And but if I didn't know that I could do these things, like if I have a bigger toolkit because I have science and an understanding of science and how I can use that toolkit.
Yeah.
And
not strictly to have not strictly in service of a physical result.
Right.
I guess that it's interesting to me. We both had the word soul come out of our mouths at the same time.
Yeah.
Because that is what I meant. I think a lot of people think about
cold, calculated.
Yeah, that it's all scientific.
Beakers bubbling and
I don't know if it goes. Yeah, but it's but that it is very that you might be sacrificing something else than people associate with food.
Uh-huh.
Because of that approach.
Right. No, I mean, imagine if a doctor thought that way.
Right.
We'd all be dead.
Right.
Or we wouldn't have what we have these days.
Right.
I mean, why is kitchen excluded from science?
Because
why? I mean, I can't understand a reasonable explanation
to
willfully be ignorant about science.
Yeah. Well, it's the line I always think of. Did you ever see the movie The Fly? This is a weird thing to bring up. With
Jeff Goldblum,
the David Cronenberg film. Uh-huh. Well, there's early on he's trying to... First of all, if anyone out there hasn't seen it,
spoiler, right?
Well, it's a brilliant film. I think it's a brilliant film. I think it's. I also can't watch it. I find it unbelievably disturbing.
It is very well made.
And Jeff Goldblum is brilliant. But that's all beside the point. He is trying to create a transporter machine.
Uh-huh.
So he has two pods in his loft, living space / lab, and he keeps. I think this is actually what the problem was with some of these, fake burgers people have been trying to make, right?
Mm-hmm.
He keeps transport animals, and they keep coming out horribly, disgustingly wrong.
Yeah.
And Gina Davis, who's his girlfriend in the movie, says the machine isn't crazed with the flesh. Like, the machine doesn't understand,
flesh.
Life. Yeah.
Organic matter,
life, flesh, live, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's like his breakthrough moment. He realizes he needs to find a way to program that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think of when I think about
people
who approach, in my opinion, what you do in the right way, right? And people who got swept up in the thing we started this interview talking about.
Right.
Is that a crazy analogy?
No, it's a pretty good analogy because it's you either have a superficial understanding of it.
Yes.
Or you want to take the deep dive. And we take the deep dive.
Yeah.
And we hope that deep dive, people could get, if they get a few morsels from that and it's something that they can use, that's our purpose.
Yes.
I mean, that is the main objective.
Great. Thank you for your time.
This was great.
It was great to meet you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for this week. Caitlin.
Andrew.
I need you here every week.
I can't promise that.
No. We got to do this every week. I love that we did. This is not one of those things where we do it the morning of.
Yes.
But I just need you to be a part of this every week. It really makes the show better.
Okay.
Listen to me.
Okay, I'm listening.
Listen to how happy I am.
I'm listening.
Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody. I want to thank our guests, Barbara Lynch, Claudette Zepeda Wilkins, Ken Frank, Francisco Magoya, Naisha Arrington, to the people at Chef's Roll, especially Cindy and Franz for being such amazing hosts when I was there, to Jeremiah Tower and his old crew who we're going to hear from on a future episode in the next couple of weeks, thanks to you guys as well, to everyone at Heritage, especially G. Paul, our engineer, for splicing these things together. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we will see you back here after our mid-season hiatus on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.